Hello.
Hello.
We're gonna have Rob joining us here, so let me see if he's ready.
Is it me you're looking for?
Lionel Richie,
I
are you
see
wondering where I am? No, I don't know the lyrics. Go
something
ahead.
like that. I don't really know it either. That's all I know. I got as far as I could get.
Hello, is it me you're looking for? That's the only lyric I remember. Damn.
That's okay. It's a pretty old song.
Maybe Rob could complete it for us.
It's back in the news, though, because of Adele. She's got her own Hello.
Okay. Oh, she's redoing it?
No, it's just got the same name, but people were making the
I gotta buy
comparison.
that new one because I'm a fan of hers. I didn't used to be into that type of music, but welcome, and we have a special guest, Rob Kreider.
Hello?
Hello.
We
How do
got
you
a brunch
pronounce the
buddy.
last name, Rob?
Oh, it's Krieger.
Krieger. Okay. Krieger.
So you guys can hear me okay?
Yes, you sound good.
Yeah. Okay, good.
Yeah.
I got sick of walking around the house with a cell phone in my ear for
Yeah,
these
it's
conversations.
rough. It's rough unless you have like a Bluetooth contraption you could hook up to your phone.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So how are you guys doing this morning?
We are doing good. We were just talking about Lionel Richie's Hello.
Oh.
And we only know one lyric. Is it
Me
me you're
too.
looking for? I don't
I
know the next line. Damn.
can't help you. I think
Yeah.
probably the majority of people don't know more
Well,
than that.
but that was a popular song in the 80s.
Yeah.
I mean, it even had his video. Like, I remember seeing that on MTV, or maybe it was VH1 because it was a softer music.
Probably.
Yeah.
I still haven't heard Adele's new song, Hello.
Yeah, I haven't.
Weird.
We're
Yeah,
just talking
I think
about
I've
that.
just heard little snippets of it here and there. I haven't actually heard the song from start to finish, I don't think.
Yeah.
But it's kind of everywhere.
I gotta buy that because I'm a fan.
Adele?
I am, and
Yeah, so am I.
it really falls out of my wheelhouse, but I think as I'm getting older, I'm like exploring more. Because like I came from like a rock and roll new wave background, and now I'm listening to all kinds of stuff. I'm into 40s music. Can you believe that? Like I'm like so into it.
Yeah,
Well,
that
you
I
are
think that's
pretty
a
old.
product of getting older too. You just expand your horizons.
Yeah. So you're probably 10 to 15 years younger than me.
Me?
Yeah, I would think.
No. Mm-mm. I think I asked you one time. What are you, like 46 or something?
Yeah.
I'm gonna be 44 in 3 days.
Oh, you look younger.
Well, thanks.
Yeah.
No, see, that's actually I was. It was really interesting and exciting to start kind of following you on Twitter and everything else because we're very close to the same age. You started obviously collecting just a few years before I did,
Oh, yeah.
and. Just in tr and you're one of the few people that I know that has been solidly collecting like I have from a little kid all the way up.
Yeah, I never ever stopped.
Yeah, I mean, I took breaks when I w as I was growing up through my teenage years,
Yeah.
6 months, 8 months, and then I'd regret it and have to go back and get everything that I missed for those 6 or 8 months. But I haven't since probably I was in my 20s. I haven't. Like early 20s, I haven't taken any break at all. But I mean, I basically have everything from like, everything that I collected from like, I'd say maybe 10 years old and up. So, talking like 35 years almost.
Yeah, I have everything that I got except for the things that I traded for something else. So we used to trade comics, so
Oh,
that
yeah.
was like a huge thing, like at school and the neighborhood. It was like
Yep.
you couldn't afford much, so you'd buy the one and then it would make 10
Hey.
before it got in, it would make its way around the neighborhood.
Exactly.
But yeah, welcome to Geek Brunch Retro, and
Thank you for having me.
you just missed Chris Ivey at the last convention, right?
Yes, I did. Chris, I wanted to ask you, whereabouts do you live?
I live, let's see, like southeast of the city. The I'm Lancaster in, area?
Oh, okay. I'm in Tonawanda, so I'm north of the city.
Gotcha. Yeah,
so
for those that don't
you get
know,
the
we're
snow
in the same area.
You get the snow, and we don't get the snow.
Right. Yeah, we do tend to get more down here. But I grew up in near Niagara Falls, so I'm familiar with the Niagara County area.
Gotcha.
Have you ever gone over Niagara Falls?
Oh,
in
yeah.
A, in mean, a barrel?
Yeah, all the time.
Naked?
There's
sort
is
of
there
a
any
rite
other
of passage.
Way?
Is there any other way? That's the only way you fit in the barrel, right?
Right.
You have to strip down.
They might turn the falls off. Did you see that?
I heard that. Yeah, that they.
How do you turn the falls off? Is there a dam right before it, or what?
Oh, there's just a knob that they turn like a faucet.
Right.
There's a faucet.
Yeah.
So this isn't natural. I always thought this was natural. I didn't know it was like. Man-made,
no,
and you turn the faucet.
It's natural, but I don't know exactly how they have something up where they can turn it off. They've done it once before, like a long, long time ago, and now there might be a couple bridges that they need to fix. So they might actually like dam the whole thing in the next couple of years to fix a bridge, and
what?
Then.
Oh, okay, so they're doing it to fix some structure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I thought that they had done. I knew that they had done it before. For some reason, when my wife told me that they were doing it, for some reason I thought in my lifetime they had done it before.
Oh,
but I guess it's been longer.
I thought
I
it
must
was
just
a long
be
time.
Thinking. Yeah, it was longer than that. I guess I must just be thinking of times where it's frozen or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's pretty cool. Have you ever seen it, Mike?
No, I've never been. All the places I visited are south of that area, so.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
I mean, it's something to see, but I'm sure, Chris, you probably agree. If you grew up here, it's just water going over.
No, that's a kind of a big deal because
yeah.
That's a Superman 2 or 3. I can't remember. 3?
I think 2.
Is it
is
2?
It,
oh, yeah,
it,
it's 2.
That's
where he gives up his powers and they go into the honeymoon suite.
Right, right, yeah.
So there's a little retro for you.
Yeah, it doesn't have as much of appeal, but it's cool.
Yeah, we go every once in a while just to check it out, just to walk around. But
it's definitely nicer on the Canadian side.
Oh yeah,
but same thing with Canada. Like especially like growing up, literally a few minutes by car from the border, you don't think of it as much of as another country.
No.
As I do Mexico, because it's on the opposite side.
Do you go over to Canada anytime?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, we just like we'll go over there even just to like hang out on that side of the falls. They have a lot more things to do there.
Yeah.
Touristy type things. And then
your passport across or what?
You could use a passport. I mean, years ago before 9/11, you could just go across and just verbally say you're an American citizen and you didn't need anything at all. But yeah, now it's either passport or in New York, they have a enhanced driver's license that like has that coding in there that shows that you're an American citizen. I guess it's like harder to forge. So I have that instead of a passport.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. I had
the
enhanced one for a while.
You have one too?
I had one of those for a while and then I needed to get a passport for,
He failed his driving exam.
I thought I'd fly a plane instead.
He couldn't drive the stick shift. He just couldn't. They
That's
gave him
true.
The stick shift.
If I did have to take it that way, I'd be screwed.
If there's any big like concerts that I really want to see, or even the big the comic book expo that they have up in Toronto. We'll go up to Toronto every once in a while. And cause that's like a 2-hour drive.
Nice. I bet I've wanted to go there.
Yeah. It's nice.
I want to visit Canada at some point. One of my college buddies, was French Canadian in Quebec. And I'd love to see him again. Cause we went through some rough times studying. We had a bond. So, yeah, I'd like to see him at some point.
Cool.
Well, you guys can come visit here and see the falls, and then we can go up to Canada.
Yeah. Good day, eh?
Exactly.
I'll bring some bag bacon with me. I love Stranger Brew and those guys, Second City.
Yeah, it's... Mike, it's so funny to talk to you live for the first time because I feel like over the past year or so, we've become friends without actually ever speaking to each other.
Yeah, this is but, the, I mean, the
not
first
seeing
time.
Each other, of course, but yeah, never even speaking to each other.
Yeah, yeah. Well, how did we meet? Through the Valiant Central or Valiant Podcast? I can't remember.
Valiant Podcast. I started listening to the three of you on there, and then I started following you all individually and just, went from there.
Yeah, yeah. That's where I thought we met. You're a huge Valiant fan.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So I thought we – this is the first time we've had a – well, no, it's not the first time. We've had maybe three guests before, but we're kind of doing this like as a regular thing just to change it up a little bit. So I thought we'd like ask you some retro questions and just answer to the best of your ability. They're more like, okay, like in high school, what were your like – musical influences. So I could kind of like know what you were tuning to as opposed to what I was tuning to. Like for me, I was huge Outfield fan and like Night Ranger and Van Halen 5150 was big. But I also had like a, you know, Depeche Mode and a lot of like new wave bands and stuff. Just out of curiosity, what were some of yours?
When I was in high school, from middle school all the way through high school, I was a huge heavy metal guy.
All right.
Heavy metal. That's all I would listen to is hard rock and heavy metal. So my favorite band at that time by far was Iron Maiden.
Oh, nice. Right?
And then, all the other bands that kind of you would fall along with it. So my first concert that I ever went to was Ozzy and Anthrax opened for them. So
nice.
that was I was probably in eighth grade or something like that. And all of that type of music, just hard rock, heavy metal. Let's see, Guns N' Roses, Motley Crue, the hair metal. You know, a lot of that back in the day and stuff. And then as I started to get into college and stuff, that's when the Seattle and alternative thing really started to hit, and hard rock kind of faded away pretty quickly.
Yeah, it became like alternative and grunge.
I really got into the alternative stuff for quite a long time. But yeah, in high school it was all about heavy metal.
See, middle school it was heavy metal. So I think that might be the 2 year delta there. Yeah, I used to write like I was huge AC/DC. Like AC/DC was my shit. They still are. I don't know. A lot of their stuff sounds very similar, but I like hear all the differences and I just love it. And then
it sounds good though.
Yeah, like
it
old
sounds similar, but in a good way.
Even David Lee Roth, like Van Halen, was like huge.
Oh yeah, I love my first musical purchases were on cassette tape. And I bought – my first one was Def Leppard Pyromania.
Oh, my God. You just mentioned my favorite.
It was awesome.
I must have heard that cassette. Like, I don't know. I knew every song after the – Ooten, Gleeten, Glob, Glotum. I knew every song that went after it. I can memorize it. And then it was weird hearing them on the radio because you were waiting for the next song. Like,
I loved it.
Yeah, it was such a inspirational time for me.
But with what you said, Van Halen, that was my second tape, and that 1984.
Oh yeah, yeah.
So those were my first two purchases.
I was in the earlier time period for Van Halen, like Fair Warning. But I went back like there was a friend that I had that lived in my neighborhood, and she was heavy into like metal. And she got me into it, and I bought a lot of 8-tracks.
Oh wow!
Like I had Van Halen, Fair Warning, Van Halen 1, and Van Halen 2 on 8-track. I had like old school Foreigner.
How old were you? Would you say?
I don't know. That was middle school. So
yeah, because 1984. I mean, that tells you the year it was. So I was 12.
Yeah.
You know, that's when I really started.
I was 5.
I was 12. You were 5. You're a young kid.
What we want to know what your influences were at 5, Chris.
At five,
yeah,
Barney. It was an eclectic mix because I liked my dad's records and tapes, and I also had my own. So it was like a mix of like Alvin and the Chipmunks and Phil Collins.
Yeah, if I go that far back, my first album vinyl was like Disco Duck or something like that.
But I did get into a lot of the hair metal stuff that you guys did just while I was in elementary school. I'm kind of surprised I was allowed to listen to it, but I agree with my parents' decision. It never really had that bad of an influence on me, even though I was really young. So, I went through a lot of the same musical genres or transitions and stuff just at a younger age. But I also had a hip-hop period mixed in there in between the hair metal and the grunge. But grunge for me was high school.
Yeah.
Late middle school, early high school.
I think that's the only one I haven't tasted yet. Like I have hip hop. I've done a little bit, and I used to like know some raps. But I never really bought the CDs or anything. I mean, the closest I ever got was the Beastie Boys, but I wouldn't consider them hip hop. I mean, they're kind of like it, but they're kind of rap-ish.
I would definitely count them as hip hop, but they do definitely cross over.
Yeah,
more than other groups do.
Yeah, I never really got into rap and hip hop very much. I bought a couple CDs, but I never really got into them. I gotta tell
Knutson loves them, like Keith. Oh my god, especially when he's drunk.
I gotta tell you something funny. When I told you that I liked my favorite band was Iron Maiden, well, it's the like, you know what the album covers of Iron Maiden look like.
Oh, Eddie, yeah.
Right. So that greatly concerned my parents, as me being a kid in eighth grade, however old that is. And so I bought them on record purposely because I thought the artwork was just amazing.
Yeah.
And I wanted to have the biggest pictures of them. So I went ahead and bought my first album was Power Slave. Yeah, I think that was like 84, 85. So I remember my mom actually pulling out the album, and sure enough, all the lyrics are printed on the sleeve. And mm-hmm. she went through into all the lyrics to make sure there was nothing. And then she's like, "All right, well, this doesn't seem too bad." And then she let me listen to it.
That's cool. Well,
they had the one that opens up with the number of the beast, 666, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I purposely did not buy that one. Like, I don't know how.
So I was like, "Did she read?"
No,
I don't know which one that was, but I know that song so damn well because that was the like high school. No, it was maybe my sophomore year in high school, and we made a music video of that, and we almost burned my friend's house down because we got like a hairspray thing,
oh my God.
We like lighted it, and we caught his bed on fire. But we started it off with the number of the beast is 666. You know, we started playing it real loud, and then we got that hairspray thing, and the bed caught on fire. We're like, oh fuck!
Oh my god, that's crazy.
Yeah, we did.
I actually got into Iron Maiden. I might not have otherwise, but one of my buddies in the neighborhood growing up, that was the same age as me, he had a brother that was about 4 years older than us, so. You know, he'd be in his early 40s now. And he was really into Iron Maiden. So his younger brother that was my age got into him as a result. And he had all the posters up on his walls and stuff like that. And so I would borrow his cassettes and stuff and we got into him. And especially Stranger in a Strange Land and Seventh Son. It was around that time. So those were the more current ones. When I was like seven or so.
It's funny because, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that actually last year, maybe the year before, just due to like Spotify and those kind of things where you can listen to whatever you want, I went back and listened to quite a bit of their catalog and a lot of it stands up.
Mm-hmm. I think it's still pretty good today. Very good musicians. And he was a very good, Bruce Dickinson, he's a very good singer, like in terms of having sustaining notes, not just screaming.
Yeah,
really good job. But I was very
somewhere in time
when even in eighth grade, I was very aware of what, you know, trying to hedge my bets with getting these albums. Because Power Slave is just, it was the least offensive cover of the album. It's the Egyptian themed one. And it's just basically the big pyramid with, you know, Eddie, like a, almost like a pharaoh.
Yeah.
And, I would have never, like, as my first one, I would have never bought, like, something like Number of the Beast, because I knew my parents would have gone nuts. So I started with that, and then after that, it was kind of like, okay, it's not so bad. Then I was able to buy the rest of them.
And generally speaking, except for a few obvious examples like Number of the Beast, their lyrics were something that's fresh in my mind because I went back and listened to them.
Yep.
Were a lot of times very literal, and more often were just telling stories and stuff.
They were stories.
Mm-hmm. There wasn't a lot of shock value and stuff like that in there. There was no
swearing in their music, which is very
That's true.
And it was all stories. And that was my point to my parents. I'm like, listen, I'm listening to this album. I'm listening to these stories. How is that any different from watching a movie about like a devil worshiper? Isn't gonna make anyone turn into a devil worshiper because you're watching this movie. It's not gonna make anyone turn into one for listening to a song.
You got to remember all the controversy at the time about playing records backwards and stuff and getting all those messages.
And parents would just see these news stories that were sensationalized for the sake of viewership and stuff, and it really spread. And it wasn't like today you could just go on the internet and, you know, find the truth, which is, you know, what the internet is good for. It tells you the truth right away.
Right, exactly.
After you go through about 12 different stories of false, it's finding the truth in the legitimate website is the key.
Just one Facebook, everything on there is true.
Right.
Facebook is horrible.
Oh my God, the things that people share on there.
Yeah, it's horrible, especially like news stuff. It's like so false.
I know.
And the thing that amazes me is the people that believe it.
Yep.
They don't even look to see what they reshare to see if it's legit.
Yeah. My wife's mom does that all the time. She posts something and it's like so not true. And then I'll link an article proving that it's not true. She doesn't respond.
She said, it's true in my mind.
Exactly.
It's true in my mind. You don't know what you're talking about. Yeah, we all have relatives that do that. So how about movies?
Oh, God.
Some things that were like an influence or things that stand out in your mind.
When I was a kid, the thing that as a younger kid, not high school necessarily, but the thing that I feel like shaped my childhood was Star Wars.
Yeah, I think it did all of us.
Like 12, right? Between Star Wars and Return of the Jedi.
Well, let me ask, you're a little bit younger than me. Did you see Star Wars at the theater?
Yep, my parents.
First one?
They took me out of school for kindergarten. I was in kindergarten. They let me skip kindergarten, and we went and saw Star Wars.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember that very distinctively. I remember the theater. I remember everything, and it was like there was just nothing that compared to it.
No.
At the age I was, there was just like everything I had seen before that was just like it wasn't even close. You know,
it absolutely blew me away.
I didn't know how to deal with it. Mm-hmm. And it seemed like after that, there was a lot more other stuff like Superman and, you know, just a lot of other things that influenced.
And then, of course, Raiders of the Lost Ark came in 1980.
Oh, God.
I was eight years old, so.
That movie, I love more and more with each watch. And I think it's because my fascination with the 40s, too. I just – that time period is just amazing to me. And I would love for them to go back to that well, like down to Disney, you know, could play with it, I think.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah. I think Disney, as much as they are like they want to intake money, they don't let their properties go stale.
No, they don't.
That's the one thing I like about them having these things, because there's other people that will.
Agreed.
Yeah.
I mean, say what you want about now. Me and you and Chris. I don't know if you. I'm assuming you saw Star Wars, The Force Awakens.
I finally got called out. I still haven't seen it.
Are you kidding me?
I was trying to keep that a secret. No one has asked me directly.
Oh my God, it's so good. But
I know, I'm
my
the
point
only
is that George. I mean,
hasn't.
To be honest, George Lucas was not going to be making any more of the movies. He just wasn't going to make any more. So I'm
well. He was a different person though after the trilogy.
Oh, like, absolutely.
He changed dramatically, which is awesome, and that's cool. And I like the fact that the prequels, like there's another generation that loved the prequels. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
So like, I really dig that it could capture another audience. But to see this back, I mean, it's just something that it's something magical that like. You see the Millennium Falcon and they're running to this heap of junk and it's the Falcon and you're just like, oh shit.
Yeah.
That's the best spacecraft ever. Like,
and that's my point.
Yeah.
You know, is that you know, I'm very happy that Disney bought it because they're going to do a lot with it now.
Oh yeah. We're going to get a movie every year. And I love that.
Me too.
I mean, there's things that I always think about, like, my life is finite, and I can't imagine how much I'm not going to see. But when I was a kid, I didn't think I would be seeing what I'm seeing now. Like, I never in my wildest dreams thought I'd see, like, seven superheroes or comic book movies a year. You know, like, big stuff, you know?
No, it would have been it was unheard of. I mean, like you said, we got Superman and Superman 2.
Or the Marvel TV movies like Spider-Man, Deadly Dust. It was like Nicholas Hammond. I was like, yeah! I broke my arm playing Nicholas Hammond on the fence because I was like, you know, I was doing the da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, you know, and walking, you know, shooting webs and falling off a wall. But those things, like, I loved. Like, I always watched $6 Million Man, Bionic Woman, Wonder Woman, like, was huge, and then, you know, Incredible Hulk, and then all that, even though that Amazing Spider-Man wasn't successful, I watched it religiously. Mm-hmm. Like, I loved it.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's amazing when you think of what you know, what we've seen and what's still to come.
Yeah, it just, it's crazy. Like, this is a cool time to, like, you just turn on the TV and you see all this stuff on, and there's always like Easter eggs that they throw at us old folks. Every it could just be a little wink, wink, and it's like, oh shit, I know that. You know, it's like, thank you.
Exactly.
And I'm a very simple person. Like, I don't like critique things like hard or anything because it's simple. Like the movie, like Hulk, all he has to do is say Hulk smash, and I'm like, oh shit. It's like the comic books, you know? He's like breaking shit up. Like, it's that simple, and it's like, wow, that I just never thought I'd see a lot of this stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what else? We had the Indiana Jones movies, we had Star Wars. I was a huge fan of E.T., a huge fan of Close Encounters.
Close Encounters, it was like all the payoff at the end.
Oh yeah, but you know what?
It took a while to build up for me. I need to revisit it now because I only saw that movie once.
You need to watch that again. And even me, I was probably like six when it came out. I remember seeing it and still loving it. And because you're right, I mean, it is a slow build, and you would think a 6 or 7 year old would have no interest in it. I loved it.
Yeah.
And to watch it now, I could watch it any day of the week.
I'm a huge fan of Richard Dreyfuss though too. So
yeah. Oh, Jaws.
Oh, Jaws, there's another one.
Yeah.
I didn't see that until I was an adult.
Oh, yeah.
I only saw that a few years ago, but it's a really good film.
It is.
I liked it a lot.
Yeah, that's another one I could watch any time. There's a few out there that I could just watch any time.
Jaws and Jaws 2.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And then it got kind of ridiculous.
Jaws 3D was not the best movie.
But I even loved going to, like, Universal Studios. I don't know if you ever went when they had that Jaws exhibit and you're just going through – and the shark jumps out at you. Because Universal Studios was awesome, like, when I was a kid, because you'd go through this, like, It was a little truck they drive you through, and they would drive you through the Jaws exhibit, and then they drive you through like the $6 million man Sasquatch circular ice thing.
Yeah.
Like I was like, oh my God, I'm in this thing, I'm in this tunnel. And then you like they drive you through this like Battlestar Galactica scene, and I was like, oh my God, it was like my whole childhood. I was like, this is awesome.
That's awesome. I'm watching, I don't know if this counts as, I think it might be 10 years old now. We're watching the redo of Battlestar Galactica.
Yeah.
I already watched the I watched the whole thing. And then I told my wife, I'm like, listen, watch the limit the miniseries. I think it was like two parts or something like that. I don't remember,
Yeah.
but I'm like, watch this with me. If you don't like it, fine, then we're done. And she's like, yeah, that was pretty good. So we watched the first season. She could not watch it fast enough.
Yeah,
And
that's awesome.
we're about a quarter of the way through the third season now. So yeah, she's loving
Yeah, it was a good series.
it. Yeah.
One that I actually completed from beginning to end.
Yeah, I didn't watch any of it until it was already. First time I watched it was like 3 years ago.
I
It was
think I
already done.
watched it late too. I didn't watch it as it was showing on the Sci-Fi Channel.
Yeah, it was free on Prime, so I
I
watched it
watched
that
it.
way.
I watched it via discs. I bought the discs.
I liked it so much that after I watched it free on Prime, I bought the discs. And that's how we're
Yeah.
watching it now.
Yeah. Yeah, the original is what spawned me to like that property, and then the remake was totally different. And
Yeah.
it went in places that I think are really, really bizarre. But it is really good. It's really good. And you can see like similarities between Starbuck and Starbuck, even though they've changed sex.
I remember reading when that was going to be coming out and an uproar about the fact that they were going to make Starbuck a woman. And then, of course, it comes out and she's the most popular character on the show.
Yeah, I really liked her in
She's
that.
amazing.
She's my favorite character,
Me
actually.
too. Me too.
Yeah.
That
But
happens so much. People complain about changes. You know,
yeah,
we're all familiar
before they
with
see
that.
anything, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
How about
Makes sense.
comedies? Did you go to any? Do you remember any like other genre movies that are outside of it?
Oh, sure.
Like I remember like Tin Conways and
Private Eyes?
Don, yeah, Private Eyes. Like I am so fond of that movie. Like Don Knotts and like that pairing, like of them, like an Apple. I think they were together in
Apple
Apple Double
Dumpling Gang.
Gang.
See, I didn't watch any of those in the theater, but we watched them on, my parents had HBO, so we watched them on HBO.
I watched them on HBO too.
Yep. Awesome. Awesome. Me and
And
my
I taped
brother.
them. I taped them, and that's why I watched them like over and over again. Yeah.
We loved Private Eye. I eventually bought it on DVD. I just had to. It's so good.
Yeah. I
And,
lo love Tim Conway and Don Knotts.
oh my God.
Especially Tim Conway and like Harvey Korman and the Carol Burnett show.
Yeah.
My
I
God.
was a big fan of Carol Burnett show.
I used to love how he play that slow, that guy that would barely walk around across the room, you know, with Carol Burnett with the secretary and stuff. Oh my
Yeah.
God. I love that show. And
Yeah,
Mama's Family spun out of that.
there was a lot of different comedies that I can't think of a lot of them off the top of my head, but we watched a lot of Ghostbusters, obviously. Fletch, have you seen Fletch?
Oh God, Fletch and Fletch Lives. Che
Yes.
Chevy Chase was like, I think my go-to comedy guy.
Oh, he's
Like,
awesome.
I used to love his movies, like Foul Play with Goldie
Yes, Goldie
Hawn.
Hawn.
Yeah,
That's another HBO one.
sounds like we were watching a lot of the same things on HBO. But yeah, he was great. How about you, Chris? Comedies, early on.
Comedies. Ghostbusters. I'm trying to remember. It's hard to separate what I did actually watch then versus stuff that I went back to watch and got into, you know, because I got into a lot of those 80s comedies that you're talking about with Bill Murray or Chevy Chase or a lot of the SNL guys, and I can't, sometimes my memory is kind of fuzzy as to whether I watched them back when or
Stripes.
when I got a little older. Yeah, Stripes. Like
Stripes
I
was
became a
awesome because it was rated R. And at that
yeah.
time, it was like, oh boy,
Uh-huh.
Private
Yeah.
Benjamin.
I know I didn't see that one back then, Stripes. I know I didn't see that till I was an adult.
Yeah, me. Well, I was a teenager.
Yeah, but
One of the obscure ones I watched, and I posted on this recently, but I remember it very fondly because of the boobies, was The Stuntman with Peter O'Toole. It was like nominated for an Academy Award, or he was.
Oh, I do
And
not remember that one.
this was one that played on the movie channels too. And I didn't see this at the theater, but I remember distinctively it was about a producer that was trying to kill the stuntman and like make the stunts deadly and stuff like that. And he crashed through a window in one of the nude scenes of the movie, and I was like, holy mackerel.
Now
Or
let me ask you this.
stir
Did you
crazy. I love stir
I don't
crazy.
think I've ever seen Stir Crazy.
Oh my
I
God,
mean, I
Jack.
know what it is, but I've
I mean,
never.
Gene, what's his name?
Gene Wilder.
Wilder. Yeah, Gene Wilder and Richard Pryor.
Yeah.
Their movies, that's a pair right there.
Oh yeah.
They were fantastic together.
I was going to ask you, did you ever watch The Volunteers? It's John Candy and Tom Hanks. They are
Don't
they
think I've watched that, even though I think I've watched the majority of John Candy's films.
He they are like he's a rich guy who try I can't remember he's trying to get out of something and he goes and into the Peace Corps and they go to like I can't remember if it was Vietnam or whatever, but anyhow, it's in Southeast Asia. And it was, I mean, it's a cheesy movie, but I absolutely loved it. I'm looking, you can get it for $4.72 on Amazon on DVD.
The Volunteers. I have to look at that.
Was very entertaining, but I don't know how, you know how sometimes when you watch something as a kid,
Yeah.
You love it, but if you don't watch it until for the first time until you're a fully grown adult, you don't really have the same appreciation.
Right.
So that I could
Well,
see definitely is
Chris
that's
had
what
me watch The Blurbs, which was another Tom Hanks movie, and I liked that one. That was pretty good.
yeah, I think I've seen that one maybe just once.
That was on instant streaming. That was a Tom Hanks one. It was really weird. It's like this family's moves next door and they're insane. And everything in the neighborhood, they're like curious about these people that work at night and do weird stuff. And I think they even drive a hearse. Didn't they have like a weird car?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, like pretty much like a hearse.
And then I was
Well,
a huge fan of like John Hughes films. Like
oh
they were
yeah.
like huge for me, like Breakfast Club and Pretty in Pink and all those movies I'd watch. And then like he did Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, which is one of my all-time favorite holiday movies.
It's one of the best comedies. Well, because it's more than a comedy.
Well, it's got like some emotional undertones that
So
it
emotional. I the end is just
They're
so
so deep. Like I watch that and I'm in tears, you know?
it's an amazing movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. What about Brewster's Millions? Did you ever see that?
Oh yeah, of course. Richard Pryor.
Yeah, so all like I watched a lot of those movies when I was a kid growing up in high school and middle school.
Teen Wolf.
Teen Wolf, sure. Yep. Teen Wolf
Oh
2,
yeah.
Jason Bateman.
Yeah. Back to the Future, of course.
Yes.
Yeah, so that gives a little flavor. We're in the same ballpark for sure.
Oh yeah.
And yeah, the HBO thing was a big thing. Like, do you remember those channel blocks clickers for the old cable boxes?
No.
Oh, okay. This was like the first generation cable boxes where it had like three tiers, but it was a switch. It was like a mechanical switch. It wasn't like you just changed the channel. It was like you'd click it on one and then you'd get like 30 channels on the first one. You click it on two, you get another 30, and you click it on three. I'll have to post a picture of those.
Really?
Yeah.
And what did it do? It kept you from seeing some
No,
of them,
it
or
was just
allowed
a
you to
way
do
of
it?
changing channels because the remote wouldn't work.
Oh, no, I don't
Yeah.
even remember
And
that.
I don't even know if this was like for old TVs that didn't have
Right,
like
because like
in the
our
exception
first
of those
TVs
that
only
didn't
had
have a
like,
remote, yeah.
right, it was only a dial, right?
Right.
TV, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, you know what? One other thing. It just reminded me. Splash with John Candy and Tom Hanks.
Oh yeah, yeah, that's a great one.
Yeah, it's a classic.
So, how about cartoons? Did you watch? Did you get up early in the morning, watch Saturday morning cartoons?
Oh yeah, but you know what? I think some of my favorites were the old Looney Tunes, like the old, like the 40s.
Yeah,
like
we're shorts. Yeah, we're in the same boat.
I loved those, and of course the Super Friends. I love the Super Friends.
Yeah, that's actually what got me into comics, really.
Is it?
Super Friends, yeah.
Yeah. Oh my God.
I mean, hardcore, especially DC.
I loved the Super Friends, and I always thought it was fascinating. Like in some of the, I think the later ones when they suddenly, like there was a new superhero. I'm like, who is that? I'm like, oh, it's the Flash. And just as a little kid to like see something other than Batman, Robin, Aquaman, Wonder Woman, and Superman. It's like, oh yeah. My God, there's somebody else. There's a different superhero.
I also love that too. It's the obscure stuff.
Like yeah, and it's like, oh my God, hell? Who is that?
That's Hawkman. Oh shit, yeah. That's Adam.
Yeah, and those then became like my favorites because like everyone didn't know them, and it was like super super interesting to me to learn about all these different superheroes.
And then they had the ones that weren't even in comics, like Apache Chief.
Right.
I used to love that. He would grow and fight Gigana.
But who was that lightning guy? I forgot.
Oh, Black Vulcan.
Yeah, Black Vulcan, yeah.
And then the samurai guy with the red tornado.
Yes.
Yeah. I think there was a third one, but I don't – there was like an Aztec guy, but I don't remember his name. Yeah, maybe he was Aztec. I don't know. But
the only reason those guys are familiar to me is because they ended up making DC Universe classics of them.
They sure did. But you know what? That's when they were exploring with diversity. That's why they made these characters.
It's funny. That's right. It doesn't occur to you when you're a little kid.
It never occurs to you.
No, it's just another superhero.
It's just another superhero.
Yeah.
But if you look at all the characters they put in there,
mm-hmm.
they were all targeting a diverse, bringing diverse characters into the Justice League.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can't think of a lot. I mean, I G.I. Joe, Transformers, those were a little bit older. You know, I think I was definitely over 10.
Yeah, that's weird because those ones, I think, is when I started to drop out of cartoons.
Well, that makes sense because I was probably maybe 12 years old. You would have been 14, 15, and you're probably, yeah. You know, I'm not really going to watch a lot of cartoons.
I would always watch the Marvel stuff.
Those are after-school cartoons, too.
Yeah, I would still watch the Marvel. Oh, and but the USA Today, they would have the after-school cartoons, and I'd watch those. And those were like retro.
Yeah.
I'd see Space Ghost and the Herculoids and all that kind of stuff. The Wacky Races.
Yes, yes. Chris, what kind of cartoons did you watch?
I think some of the stuff that you mentioned that were on when you were starting to move out of things were the prime for me, you know, G.I. Joe, Transformers. That was all my prime time period. And for me, when I kind of was on that borderline, like you were, it was more the Ninja Turtles and stuff where I was kind of into them, but I was kind of starting to get a little too old for it. But I was definitely still... When I was growing up, Saturday mornings were still definitely a thing. You know, we didn't have the Cartoon Network yet. We didn't have those dedicated channels or streaming where it kind of, as a result, Saturday morning cartoons not really a thing anymore, you know?
No, it's kind of sad, isn't it?
It's almost like kids today, they could watch anything they want.
Anytime they
want. But I almost appreciate the fact that we had to work for it. I had no alarm clock. I would just like have this internal clock that would say, go watch the bars on the screen until the cartoons start. And then I'd be exhausted and take a nap after around noon because I'd watch like cartoons from 6 a.m. to noon. And then I'd pass out with I'd have my bowl of cereal there in the morning, you know, around 7 or 8.
Yeah.
And then I'd pass out around noon and take a huge nap because I had gotten up so early. And I would schedule it. Okay, ABC, I got to go here. NBC. And I'd watch all those. And the fall preview of TV Guide was like a masterpiece back then. I'd spend hours looking at it, planning strategically, how I was going to jump from one station to the next.
What I was going to tell you is that I had to rely on the advertisements in the comic books to figure out what I was going to watch when, because we didn't get TV Guide. So it's like, okay, let's take a look. This is an ad for ABC. Okay, I want to watch these shows. But then I want to watch these other ones on this channel. And of course, if they're on at the same time, then you're screwed because there's no way to watch them. There's no way to record. Right?
So Looney Tunes, Flintstones.
That's the world that Keith is still living in.
In what?
That there's no way to record. You got to catch it when it's
on.
Oh,
wait till you listen to the next DC noise. That's changed, my friend.
Oh, did you guys record last night then?
We did, finally.
Yeah.
Finally. I'm going to break, because it's been so long since we've been together, I'm going to break it up into two.
Yeah, you got to spread that out. It might
gonna
be like
spread
a
it
couple
out,
months
so,
before you
yeah,
have
before we
months.
Can do it again. So it's but yeah, that's changed. And he changed in the flip phone.
Yeah, I was going to say, I remember back when you and him only had flip phones, you know.
Yeah.
Changed.
It took us a long time to convert.
It did. I remember laughing about it, listening to you guys talk about it.
I had alternative motives, though, for keeping the flip phone because I could take it in certain places where I couldn't take any kind of device that had pictures.
Mm.
But
so you're saying the smartphones don't fit up your butt? Or
They don't. They're too big. Have you tried it?
No.
No.
Not yet.
Yeah, okay. So how about video games, last but not least?
Video games, I was a very big Atari 2600 person.
Yes.
The neighbor across the street got an Intellivision.
Mm-hmm.
So we'd go back and forth and play different games. And then they eventually went to ColecoVision. So then we spent a lot of time there because we didn't have a ColecoVision, but that was pretty cool.
Well, the ColecoVision I really loved because it really started to look like the stand-up games.
Yes.
at that time. Like you had Donkey Kong Jr. and Zaxxon and a bunch of others that were just exactly like playing the video game.
Exactly. With the Atari, you had to have a good imagination.
You just had these ugly ass. I don't know if you were into the sports games at all, but
no.
You had this ugly ass controller for the sports games. It was huge. It looked like it was, you had to like put it. It was like a gun. It had four triggers and then a joystick on top, and it had little different templates you'd put on top of that joystick.
For,
so
for
like
which?
If you play baseball, football. You'd use it for Rocky, too, because Rocky was like a boxing game.
For what system do you mean?
A ColecoVision.
Oh, okay, Coleco, yeah.
Yeah. Because I remembered liking – like I was huge into the sports, like the television sports, way better, even though that controller was just bizarre as hell.
Sure was.
It was just that pad and number
pad,
key.
No. Well, but yeah. So
I've seen that. I just can't imagine playing games with that thing.
Growing up, that was my thing, and then I kind of got out of video games for a while. I went to, I think I heard you talking about it. I went directly from the Atari to like a VIC-20. That was the precursor of a Commodore 64.
Yeah, I got the Commodore 64.
Okay, so I had a VIC-20, which is just a basic, even more basic than the 64. My brother went to like the Nintendo. And like the Sega Genesis, so you know I play his and stuff. But then I started getting into the VIC-20. Came you could buy cartridges just like for the other games, and those would have games in there.
The VIC-20 had like a joystick, but it was like a really thin joystick, wasn't it?
I think so. Yeah, I think. But and then there was a lot of like the I heard you talking about it. I think might have been with Chris last time with the like you know all those text based. Games and stuff. Like the
Choose Your Own Adventure. Yeah.
Yeah. So I played a lot of those, and then when I got rid of the VIC-20, I got a Commodore 128, which, of course, only did anything in the Commodore 64 mode because they weren't really making anything for the 128. So I played a lot of those text games and stuff like that with and then eventually I got a regular computer and played some games. like Bard's Tale. I don't know if you guys ever heard of Bard's Tale.
That I've heard of it, yeah.
A really cool, like, explore dungeon game that you would play on with a keyboard. It was a lot of fun. I immersed myself for hours, like, exploring dungeons and stuff like that. But, yeah, and that was – so that was pretty much it.
I took a different path. It was the Fairchild first generation, and then the 2600. That's probably when I was the deepest into gaming, though. Like
me too.
I spent more hours in the 2600 than any other box. And then I never had an Intellivision, but I had an uncle that did. So it was very similar to you. Yeah. And then I actually had a ColecoVision, and that one was like one of my favorites. And then I jumped to the Commodore 64, and then the Sega Genesis. And during that same time, I had a Nintendo, and then it went to Sega Saturn, and then Sega Dreamcast. I was a huge Sega fan after. That's where I spent my – and then I went to Xbox, and then I dropped out.
Gotcha. I bought a GameCube, and this is obviously more recent. Me and my wife were already married, living in this house at that point, when the GameCube first came out, and played the GameCube a bunch and stuff, and then eventually she wanted to buy a Wii, so we bought a Wii and, you know, played a few of the games on there with it. But just more casually, just like with friends and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
No actual, just, you know, sitting down and playing lots of video games.
Yeah. And
I was going to ask, Rob, is your brother that you mentioned, is he younger or older?
Yeah, he's younger.
Yeah, sounds like, because
3 years.
I'm definitely the Nintendo generation.
Yeah,
myself.
He was a big Nintendo guy. And not to say I didn't play, but it was his Nintendo. And I didn't feel like I needed a Nintendo. We would go across the street and play with friends, or, you know, if I felt like playing, I'd go over. He actually had a TV at that point in his own bedroom. So go in there and play and stuff, but it was fine. Like I kind of played a lot of computer-based games, and I felt like playing a Nintendo or a Genesis. I'd play, you know, with him.
Yeah, you didn't feel like you had to have your own.
No, yeah, I was kind of over the console games at that point, and more into computer-based games. You know, I did want to mention one thing. Up until a few years ago, when it went out of when they pulled it out back, there was a great MMO called City of Heroes, and you created your own superhero, and you know, go online and join with other people and stuff like that. And then they created a second one called City of Villains, where you could create a villain and do stuff. And it was an amazing game. It lasted about 4 years before it was NCSoft, and NCSoft just pulled the plug on it. But that was a lot of fun.
They had a comic book too.
Yeah, they did have a comic. Yep. Yeah. At first, it came free with the subscription. They gave you a month with your paid subscription, and then after a while, then they went to Image, and then you just had to buy your own comic book if you wanted it. But it was great because it was like what I always pictured. Like if I wanted to make my own superhero in a game, it had so many options for, you know, costumes, and it had a great variety of power sets, and you could basically create anything you wanted to do, and it was so much fun.
Sounds like it.
Really sad it's gone.
Matter of fact, this one has my curiosity because it's Mark Waid, Dan Jurgens, and David Wohl.
Is that the Image one?
Yeah.
Yeah. The other one was Blue King, I believe.
It was Blue King.
Okay.
Is that the one that came with the?
Yeah, that's the one that came. That
came with the games.
Yeah.
I briefly tried that. I had a period of time where I tried a lot of different MMOs. I never played that one that much, but I remember that the character creation was one of the big draws to it. Like you said, there's so many different options. You pretty much could create whatever you wanted to.
And it was so well done in terms of what you could create that it made replaying, like once you got up to like the highest level you could get up to, you would quickly like make a new character. Or obviously, you know, you didn't have to wait. You know, I had like 20 characters, and it was not boring to kind of rehash some of the stuff with a different character. the character generation was just so great that it was just so much fun to play. And I really, really enjoyed it. I miss it. A group of people – I actually became pretty decent friends with a lot of the people that I played with. Kind of they created like a super group you would join. Mm-hmm. Got to know a lot of these people. One guy, set up a website for our group and everything else. And you really got to know people because you'd play with, your headset on and you're talking to them while you're playing. So it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I did that a while with World of Warcraft. I don't play anymore, but I did have a period of time where I got to know some people and stuff. I haven't really kept in touch anymore, but yeah, that's one of the cool aspects of those games, though, is they can be fairly social.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
I never played a lot of computer games. That's weird. I remember early on, I would do like Doom and Duke Nukem on the computer.
Doom was fun, yeah.
But it was basically dial up point to point. Like I would dial my friend's number and they'd go over the
right.
the weird noise on the modem. Those old modems. And then you connect and then you'd see each other. And then after I play the games, I'd almost want to pass out because I was like bumping into dark walls like over and over again. I couldn't find my way out of a room and I was getting nauseated. And I said, okay, I can't take it anymore.
It's just not for you.
but it was cool. You could like go to the urinal and pee and all kinds of stuff like that.
Yeah. No, it was good. When it went out of business or when they pulled it, didn't go out of business. When they pulled it, bunch of people that are big into design and stuff, they're trying to create a like kind of a successor to it. They did a Kickstarter, and I actually chipped in for it. And they're still working on it. Like I still get updates. This is now going on 3 years, but they still do updates regularly. So I'm hoping that eventually someday there's a new one that comes out that's just as good.
Cool.
Yeah. Cool.
All right. Well, that was the questions that I had thought of. Do you have any you want to mention or anything that I didn't cover? Retro, and then we can get into our books.
I don't. I think I'm good.
All right. How about you, Chris?
Sorry, what?
Oh, I know what a good question is. What was your first car?
My first car?
Yeah.
The first car that I was given was I can't remember what the year would have been. This late 80s Dodge Charger that my parents had that they said that I could, they bought a new one and said that I could have it.
That's kind of a muscle car.
Yeah, it was definitely a great car to have. First car that I bought myself was a Mercury Tracer. A little bit different speed, but again, I was buying it on my own as probably 20 something years old. So, but yeah, that was my first car. What about you?
Mine was the first one I bought was of my own money was a 78 Fiat Spider.
Oh wow!
It was the worst purchase ever. It's a car from Italy. The repairs on it were like insane. I'd have to order a part from Italy, and it was awesome though because it was a convertible. Uh-huh. If you ever look at it, they looked cool. But back then, I didn't think practical. Yeah. I just thought, hey, this is cool. I want to drive it.
Well, of course, yeah.
So it was kind of a dumb purchase. It wasn't what I wouldn't have done it again, but. But my first one was a Maverick. That was my mom and dad let me have their car. It was like a 73, I think.
Wow. That's cool.
It was a Maverick. I'm getting it confused with the Mustang. And then from there, I had a two VWs and then the Fiat Spider.
Gotcha.
And Chris, I think you mentioned what yours was, right? On a previous
one. Yeah, it was a Ford Tempo. I just have to think for a second because I also had a Ford Taurus.
You were in the Fords.
A Ford Tempo, I think that was very close to a Mercury Tracer, wasn't it? They're both.
You got me.
Because a Mercury was a subdivision of Ford, and they're almost the same car.
Okay. I'm
remembering correctly. It could be a different
Ford. That wasn't by choice. It just. the first car I ever had was actually a hand-me-down from my grandfather, and then the other Ford that I had was it just happened that my parents, their neighbor runs a collision shop, and he happened to just get a good deal on a vehicle. Asked my dad if he wanted to buy it, because I needed a car, so.
Yeah, I remember when my dad actually went out and found this Mercury Tracer, and you know, it was a really good deal. So he's like, "All right, come on out and take a look at it." I go on out, take a look. It's purple. It's a purple car. I'm looking at it, I'm like, "I don't know." He's like, "Because it's purple, right?" I'm like, "Yeah." He goes, "Well, forget the fact that it's purple for a second.
Put
What about the price?"
your Prince cassette in there and you're set.
Exactly. I'm like, yeah. And you know, I was at least practical enough that I'm like, yeah, this is such a good deal. It's like, I'm going to have to just deal with the fact that I'm driving a purple car. So I drove with a
Yeah.
purple car for years.
Yeah, I had a purplish Dodge Neon for a while, and same
Not
thing.
the
I
right
was like, I
choice.
don't really want to drive this, but it's free,
Exactly.
and I can't afford a car otherwise, and I need to drive something, so I'm gonna suck it up and live with it.
I do have a question before we get started for you. Now that I think about, what do you guys know what your first comic book that you bought was, and do you still own it?
For me, no. I mean, I don't own it, but I remember it was an issue of Ghosts that I bought with my own money. Before then, it's all a blur because they all came from the city dump. Because then they had no covers, so it was
Right.
like ripped off covers, and I didn't care. It was the story,
Exactly.
and I didn't look at the little, you know, front page back then. You could see what issue it was if you look at the little words on the bottom. I never looked at that. I just read it and look at the pictures, and I was happy.
What about you, Chris?
Yeah, I know for sure that I don't own it because I don't own any of my old comics, unfortunately. Yeah, the first one I bought with my own money, I really don't know. I'm almost positive it was Marvel, and other than that, I don't really know. I know what a lot of the earlier ones that I had were, because at one point I went to that website, Mike's Amazing World of Comics, and looked at his back issue. Like, you can browse month by month by what came out and see all the cover images at once. And I kind of hit that era of Marvel and just kind of 86, 87. And there was a bunch of stuff. I had a bunch of Marvel comics that I got from my parents. And then there was a gap of time. And I just kind of read those over and over again. And then eventually, maybe like 87 or 88, started getting a ride to the comic book store. You grew up around here too, Rob? Did you go to a comic shop growing up around here anywhere? Or?
I first realized that there was such thing when I was probably about 10. Up till that point, it was the local
Convenience
convenience
store.
stores or drug stores, and just I'm like, oh, I'm going to start collecting this comic book. And then 3 months in, well, all of a sudden they're not carrying that particular
Right,
next
you just
issue, and
had
I
to,
miss it.
yeah.
But Queen City Comics is the one that I've been going to for what, like 35 years now.
Nice. Yeah. We would get, my buddy and I, our parents would take turns giving us rides sometimes. My friend's parents would, because it was a bit of a hike from the town of Niagara to get to Queen City.
Oh, yeah.
But we would get there every once in a while. It would seem like really cool. My friend's parents would take us down there, but mostly I would go to House of Fantasy
Oh,
and
okay. Yep.
downtown Niagara Falls, which
Sure.
is actually still there. I'm kind of surprised, but
Yeah, I haven't
pretty
been there since
small
I was a
place.
kid.
I stopped in there one time just for the hell of it, because you know, just to see what it was like as an adult, you know.
Yeah.
And
Different ownership or same
everything always
ownership?
changed. I think it's the same owner. I think he's got other like another guy that runs it, kind of. But I'm pretty sure it's the same owner too. I mean, it's the only. I mean, it's the only shop in the city, and you probably have to drive down your way, Rob, to get close to another one.
Yeah.
But actually, for our economy, we do have a lot of shops.
We definitely have a lot of shops for when you think about the size.
For yeah, like I guess people just like comics around here or something. You wouldn't think that it would support as many as are open around here. So I can think of four or five right away.
Yeah, which is unusual. Like a lot of you would think of probably an area this size, maybe have three at the most, probably two,
and really spread out.
Yeah. And my first comic book I ever bought was, I remember I was at a friend's house. We stopped at a convenience store and I saw a bunch of them. And of course, told you guys I was a big Star Wars guy. So I bought Star Wars number 19.
Oh, nice.
Which has a image of like a skull is the center of like this kind of like space station. It's got Luke and 3PO and a couple other bases on there and stuff. And I still have it. It's absolutely in the worst condition you've ever seen. Still have it. I put it in Mylar to keep it from getting any worse.
Yeah, it's weird. Nice. I don't know what happened to my Star Wars, but I remember I still have the big one. I have a Treasury edition of the movie.
Cool.
And then I had, but the originals I had like of the movie, and I don't know where they went. But I remember how I got them. They were in those three packs. So I got like the you know the ones that were bagged in threes.
Mm-hmm.
I had gotten the first three, and then I got the second three, and then I stopped getting them. But I don't know what happened to them. And now they're worth a fortune.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't remember what my first one was, but I do have a memory of walking. One of my other friends is a different friend than the one whose parents took us to Queen City. You could kind of cut. Walk through his backyard and then cut through a little bit of a field and then the backyard of people on the opposing side and cross the street and you could get to a gas station that way, convenience store. Mm-hmm. And so we would always walk over there and see if there was any new comics on the shelf. And like you were saying, Rob, I mean, when you bought your comics that way, you just really, you could hope to find new issues of a title that you liked, but you really were at the whim of whatever happened to be there.
Exactly.
And I know I bought several comics there, but only one I can specifically remember is there was an X-Men annual. I think it might be the Serpent. Was it Serpent's Attack or no, Atlantis Attacks or Serpent?
Oh, okay. Yeah, Serpent Atlantis Attacks too?
I think it was the Atlantis Attacks, whatever it was. I know it was a black background. I'll have to look it up. Mm-hmm. But, it was an X-Men annual, and annuals back then were always a good buy because you got a lot to read, even though they were a little more expensive.
Yeah.
But I don't have a memory of buying many comics, but for some reason I remember that I got that there.
Mine was Ghost 32. I had to look up the number. I know what the cover looked like.
Exactly.
I just remember the number.
I just did the same thing.
It's so nice on Comic Base because I just type in ghosts and I just mouse over it and it zooms in. I just had to scroll through them and look at which one it was.
Yeah, I guess I have you to blame for the Comic Base thing as well.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Oh my God. It's awesome.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of people that won't get it and I understand why. But if you have any kind of collection, though, it pays for itself within like 3 months. It really does. If you try to manage it elsewhere, it's like it's all managed for you, and all you have to do is scan it in. Bloop, bloop. I mean, you don't know how much time it saves me to get a shipment from DCBS and just start scanning. So it's like scan, 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 scan. And then once that's done, then I open up the Marvels and enter the digital codes, and then I put them in Mylar twos and halfbacks and then I put them in the reading pile.
Mike, I don't think my wife's going to agree with you that it's going to pay for itself. I think she's going to say that it's going to cost her money because I don't like seeing those little spots, those empty spots.
It's like a compulsion.
And then you get
so close. You're like, oh shit, I only have four more issues. I got to get them.
Yeah.
Oh shit, that's $400.
Because now I went to that comic shop that's down the road now. There's a Dave and Adams Chris that's on Sheridan near the Eastern Hills Mall that has a huge comic book area. Have you been in there?
Yeah, I haven't gone in a little while, but for a while I was going in there
Yeah,
whenever
so
I was bored and just looking through stuff.
they've got boxes and boxes and boxes of 50-cent comic books. And
Yeah.
these are comic books that are in pretty much very fine to near mint condition. It's just that they're being realistic in that nobody's gonna come to the store and ask for these comic books
Yeah.
specifically. Do you know what I mean? They could sit here for years before anyone would just pick them up for like what Overstreet is saying that it's worth or whatever.
Right.
So they're selling them for 50 cents. So I filled my run of Infinity Incorporated except for two books. So guess what now I'm going to have to go do? I'm going to have to buy those two books.
Yeah. MyComicShop.com. That's where
I
you
know.
go.
Exactly. And of course, the two that were missing was the first Todd McFarlane drawn one.
Oh,
And then
of
like the first
course.
one with Mr. Bones. So
That's where you find, okay, they have some kind of TV link or some key creator.
yeah.
And who would have think, like Rob Liefeld's first work is Hawk and Dove, and McFarlane's is Infinity Inc.
Exactly. Yeah.
So
So I'm like,
yeah.
why are they missing? They got like the whole run. Why are they missing these ones? It wasn't until I came home and I looked up in Comic Base, like, oh, okay, now I see why they were missing them. Because somebody went, as soon as they got that in, somebody went in and pulled those out and bought
Right.
those.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They had I read the same thing they had going through and digging through, and there's almost an entire run of Birds of Prey,
Yeah.
and then it's missing number 8, and I think, what
Oh,
the heck is that
Nightwing.
not
I
there?
know
And then, yeah, exactly.
that
So exactly, like, I think people, they get those in, they cherry pick any that happen to actually have a value and
Yeah.
sell them, and sell them normally. But
Speculators, man, once they find out that's hot,
oh yeah,
they go raid stores like
and they're
that.
50 cents, so how can you
Yeah.
beat it, you know?
They go raid those and then they flip them. They
Flip them,
flip them.
yeah. Well, I think in this case, I think Dave and Adams was taking them out before they put them in the 50
And
cent bins.
they might have too, but a lot of times, like I was talking to the guy, and he's like, you know what,
Oh,
you
really?
might find, yeah, he's like, you might find a $10 or $15 comic book because we just don't have time to go. I mean, they did go
Yeah.
through them for anything that's like really, really obviously key, but like,
Yeah.
if there's a $10 book in there, we're not pulling it out. We just don't have the time because
Yeah,
they had pallets of boxes.
right, and
Yeah.
they'll capture like the keys that like is in your memory, like my comic shop. When he got that huge collection, he knew that I knew what was valuable. But I was telling you, I'll know what's valuable that's old, but if it's speculation, I told him I won't be able to do the new stuff.
Right.
So like I did all the old stuff for him, and he graciously gave me 50% off of the collection, which I
Right.
got some really good key books.
Like
So
Mike, at this 50 cent, I actually picked up volume 2 of Armorings 2 and 3 that were sitting at 50 cents
oh,
each.
nice.
They
Nice.
didn't have, of course, they didn't have 4. But that could be that they pulled it, somebody pulled it out, or they pulled it out, or that, whoever bought it just didn't end up because it was so
Well,
hard to get.
those were the only books of Valiant that when I started Valiant around, I started collecting Valiant around Magnus 10 and Soul, just around that area.
Yeah.
And I remember Barb buying Magnus 12 for me, which is the first appearance of Turok, for like $100.
Holy crap.
So yeah, this is when Valiant was like really hot in Wizard, and they didn't have huge print runs like when Bloodshot and Turok hit.
Yeah.
So they had the coupons and you'd send away for your books and all that stuff. But I never would miss Valiant. Like the whole time once I had the comic shop, I would always put them on my pull list because there was always a pull box. And then when I came to Colorado Springs, I still had a pull box, but I remember it was a place that I went to called Gotham City Comics. They're no longer there, but they didn't get me my last few Acclaims, and I never got Shadow Man 6 or Armorings 4, and they turn out to be like, and what is the other one? Unity 3, Unity 2 number 3, or 2000 number 3, whatever it is.
Yeah.
Those they never got them because the company went under, or there was weird shipping with them, or
Yeah, those, they didn't get them themselves.
Yeah, it was the last. The comic shop didn't get them, so right. I didn't get them. And then it took me forever to go back and finish them, and they were super expensive.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I don't know if I'll ever buy four. I just don't know if it's worth it to me.
Yeah.
To spend that much money on Armorines number 4 just so I can have it.
It's just a print run, right?
Yeah, when I can spend that money on like a Silver Age book or something like that.
Exactly. And that one is going to – these ones are just really rare because there's very few of them, you know?
Right. Yeah.
A lot of the stores didn't get them. But, man, if you're going to do any of them, do Shadow Man. I love that Zero guy.
Yeah.
Of all the Acclaim stuff, when they built that New Orleans stuff, it was, like, creepy. And I know that you like horror because I see the movies you post. And I that's one of my favorite genres because my first comic that I bought was a horror
Ghosts,
book.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think you'll really dig of all the Acclaim stuff, the Shadow Man stuff.
Volume 2 of Shadow Man 1, 2, and 3. And then
that was Garth Ennis, yeah.
Yeah, and then I think I must have fallen away from it or whatever happened. I bought it at the comic shop, and then that was it. And then I didn't buy another Shadow Man until, VEI.
Well, one is dark as hell because it continues with Shadow Man's death. And
yeah.
They have him on the bed, and they're doing the autopsy, and he's like beaten to pulp.
I like how they connected that because that was the only.
Oh yeah, that was great. But actually, the next volume is the one that just blew my mind. I was like, I want to finish reading that. I've been doing those in Valiant Verses, and I just want to keep reading because it's just so good.
Yeah, and I don't
have
any of those at all.
Yeah, it's so good. But let's jump to what your one of your picks is for a retro pick.
Sure. Rob. For me? You want me to start?
Yeah, go ahead. You start. Boy. You're our guest.
Well, I think I'll start with the one that I read yesterday, which was Vigilante number 1. I haven't read this probably, since shortly after it first came out. My brother is not a comic book collector, but because I was and he was younger than me, he started collecting some comic books. But he wanted to do his own thing, so he collected a lot of books that I wasn't buying at the time. And Vigilante was one of them. So I didn't own this. I just got this last week at that 50-cent box that we were just talking about. Looks
is
like
that
just
the original or the like the Marv Wolfman?
Yes, yeah, the original.
Yeah. Okay,
yeah. Now I don't know when his first appearance was. I think it might have appeared somewhere before. Or,
well, their first Vigilante was a cowboy on a motorcycle.
Yeah, no, I don't
remember. Yeah, yeah.
But did Vigilante appear in New Teen Titans before?
I believe it's New Teen Titans, yes.
Yeah, he came out of there, yeah.
Because I know that Cyborg's in the third issue, because I bought the first three issues at the shop last week. They had just about the whole run, but I just bought three issues. Mm-hmm. So I read number 1 yesterday.
I really like that third cover.
Oh, me too.
That's really cool.
Him and Cyborg facing
off.
Yeah, that's a great cover.
It's like a Western showdown thing.
It is.
It's like raw.
And as much as I like that first one, I love the third cover. I love the first one too because it's just a really simple cover.
Yeah.
Just says Vigilante pointing the gun, right at you, and it has a newspaper behind it with like all these different tragic events, like hand severed in subway attack. And lost, she's slain in snowbound auto. And it just like all these model student killed for radio. Just all these like bad things happening. So Vigilante is Adrian Chase. And this is it just quickly gives an origin story just on the very first page. Just basically he was a district attorney and he had a ton of convictions, but on one of his biggest cases, he ended up pissing off some of these gangsters, and they set a bomb that killed his wife and kids, and it actually killed. It says it killed Adrian Chase too, but just for 7 minutes, and came back, and then they brought him back to life, and he became a different man, and now he's the Vigilante. So he's going after anyone that basically his objective is to go after anyone that's guilty but is getting away through technicalities. So he's a little bit more, I guess, selective than Punisher, but you know, even his origin is very similar to what the Punisher was on the Marvel side.
Yeah.
So the book opens up with a mobster called Mr. Quilt, and he's gardening, and he's got a henchman called Brand, and that's very literal because he's got these brands that self-ignite, have a bee on them, and they're just chatting and talking about like protecting your own and so on and so forth. And then it cuts to Brooklyn, New York, where you see a family playing video games, and the mom's coming in and they're just chatting, and all of a sudden, bam, the door opens and Mr. Brand is there, and he wants this guy's wife, saying that she owes Mr. Quilt something. And the husband's like, get out of my house and everything else. And they start fighting. And again, Brand says that, you know, he wants this woman for some reason, and he's gonna brand her face. And the husband pulls out a gun and actually shoots and hits Brand over on just in the side of the head and makes him run off. So you don't really know what's going on there, but somehow the mobster, Mr. Quilt, knows this woman. So next thing that's happening is that the husband is now on trial for this attack, even though, you know, this Brand is not anywhere to be found. And they said, yeah, okay, it was self-defense. That's not a problem. However, your handgun was unregistered, and that's against the law. You've got to go to jail for a year. So the husband's, you know, outraged. He's like, are you kidding me? I was protecting my family. And he said, Mr. Quilt got to you, Judge. And he runs out. Cuts again to Mr. Quilt's estate, and this husband breaks through the window, and he's got a shotgun. And sure enough, the judge is there, and they're toasting the judge for helping Mr. Quilt get this husband, you know, thrown into jail. And the husband's got a shotgun. He's like, damn you. And he's going to start shooting when the Brand hits the guy in the back and kills him with his actual heated brand. From that point on, it starts highlighting the vigilante Adrian Chase. And he's looking for a case, and he's got two kind of helpers, assistants, one a woman, and her name's Teresa Gomez, and then a weapons expert named J.J. Davis. So they're talking, and this woman says, you know, this lady's husband was killed last month, and she's looking for help. And the vigilante said, you know, I don't take commissions. I go after those proven guilty of crimes who are released because of a technicality. And then she gives more information, saying Quilt's behind the murder. And apparently it was Quilt that killed his family. So he's like, well, that changes things. I'm gonna go meet with her. So that's exactly what he does. He meets with her, and she said that she worked for him as a secretary, and now he's afraid that she knows too much, and that's why he's coming after her. So vigilante said, all right, I'm gonna go to his estate and see what's going on. But he's kind of got the impression that there might be more to the story than what she's saying. He gets to the estate. He's basically he's knocking out, fighting all of his of Mr. Quilt's mobsters. And then he gets to the Brand, and they're fighting each other. And Brand's about to actually get him and to kill the vigilante. And Mr. Quilt says, no, don't. He's like, I want to talk to you. He's like, this is why I want her. It's like, she's not a good person. She stole my records and been blackmailing me for years. She didn't tell you that. It's like, I'm sorry for what happened to her husband, but if she'd given me what she'd stolen, everything would be fine. And Vigilante said, Reynolds is still dead, Quilt, and I'm still going to get you, just not now. But it doesn't say, like, he's literally there right next to Mr. Quilt, but so it doesn't say why he's just not going to take care of him. He just leaves. So Vigilante just leaves, and he goes back, and he starts talking to the woman again. And in the meantime, or just before that, rather, the woman is there with her child and with her father. And her father had some sort of paperwork that she kept, had him keep. And she asks for it, and that's when the vigilante appears. And what it turns out is that this woman was not just the secretary. She actually fell in love with Mr. Quilt and got pregnant. So the little boy that she has was not her husband's, it was Mr. Quilt's. And what she was doing was she was blackmailing Mr. Quilt to stay away from the child, saying, you know, I'm going to expose you if you come near this kid. So Vigilante starts to get more information and kind of understands where this woman's coming from. And the Brand appears again, and they start fighting, but Brand's trying to kill the woman. Vigilante saves her. Brand takes off, and Vigilante follows him in his motorcycle. And they get to the boardwalk on Coney Island, and Brand jumps out of the car and starts climbing up the what is that roller coaster called? I forget.
The Cyclone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Coney Island. So Vigilante's climbing up and following them, and they're fighting right on the top near the top of the roller coaster, and sure enough, here comes a car, and they're pushing each other and shoving each other, and all of a sudden Brand turns around and goes, oh no, because he sees the cars coming, and Vigilante manages to grab the Brand, and the actual Brand, not the person, but the Brand itself, and smacks it right into the Brand's face, and he falls to his death. So then it cuts back to this woman's house, and she said, I'm leaving. I'm going as far away from Quilt as I can. And Vigilante says, don't. He's like, this is where you want to live. Don't let other people push you around. It's like, that's what I'm here for. It's like, I want to make sure that, you know, the innocent can do what they want and that the criminals aren't telling people exactly what they can do. So he said, it's time for the little man to win. And then it cuts back to the Brand's office, and Vigilante's throwing a mobster through Mr. Quilt's window. And Mr. Quilt says, what are you doing back here? Vigilante says, I wasn't finished with you. Quilt, you're through. And Quilt says, don't believe it. I've got half the judges in this town in my pocket. Vigilante says, I believe you do, but with these papers, even your old grandmother would convict you. So he says, just one question. Why? If you haven't attacked Epi, which is the woman's name, none of this would have happened. And he says, she had something that I wanted. Not the files, my son. I never knew him. I never watched him grow up. She blackmailed me to keep him away. I wanted to know him. It's as simple as that. And I'm going to get him, Vigilante. Tommy's my son, and you protect what's yours. Vigilante pulls out his gun and shoots Quilt dead. And Vigilante says, that's just what Epi was doing, Quilt, protecting what was hers. And that's the end of the book. So I thought it was a good introduction to the Vigilante. I'm definitely interested in reading the next couple issues that I bought. And if I continue to enjoy it, I'll probably go back to that store and get some more of the run for 50 cents each.
And but, then you start looking at Comic Base and you say, oh, there's holes. I got to
fill. And then there's all these holes. What the hell? I ended up there's three. Really, there's only 50 issues.
Yeah.
It's only 25 bucks.
Yeah. Can't go wrong there. Exactly. I was just looking at the covers as you were talking, and there's an issue. Well, there's a Crisis tie-in on 22, so that'll be interesting.
Yeah, because
usually you used to see, like, the Crisis on Infinite Earths tie-in bar on the top.
Yeah,
and on this one, you don't have it on 22, which is Really interesting. So I'd be interested to revisit that one. I've only read this sporadically. I have the full run, but I haven't read the entire run.
And I see 20 and 22 both guest star Nightwing, so that's
Yeah.
interesting too.
The other one that interests me is 36, which is the death of, but what
Oh
it,
yeah,
why it
who's that? The
interests me is
Peacekeeper?
the Peacemaker. That's
Peacemaker, yeah.
a Charlton character, so I was like, hey, that's pretty awesome cover. Yeah.
Yeah, so this isn't wasn't necessarily breaking new ground. This came after the Punisher. But it was definitely an enjoyable read. Marv Wolfman did a good job setting up the character, and I'm sure as it goes, it's gonna flesh him out more and flesh out his two assistants, that woman and this weapons specialist. And
Yeah.
I mean, Wolfman was a great writer, and it looks like he did the first looks like he did about 16 or issues, then picked it back up again. Alan Moore actually did a two-parter on here, issue
Oh, did
17,
he?
18. Yeah, so that's probably interesting. And
Those will
then,
be hard to find too, then. I mean,
yeah,
it's
I'm
because it's
sure.
Alan Moore.
Yeah, but yeah, I mean, I definitely enjoyed it. Like I said,
That really
really
has my
surprised.
interest right now because I'm on an Alan Moore kick with Swamp Thing, so
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
I think I'm gonna have to look 17 and 18 up and read them because it's a two-parter Father's Day.
Yeah.
Oh wow.
But yeah, I
Yeah,
definitely enjoyed it. I'll probably pick up some more. Looks like some of the earlier ones, 6 and 7, say they go more into his origin, so that might be interesting to read as well.
Really nice covers on all of them. I like
Yeah.
layout.
And you can tell these were the direct to market, and they were doing this with like Legion and Titans, and Vigilante was another direct to market book.
Yeah. I just read something recently with the female vigilante with it was a Deathstroke issue.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. The blonde hair, she didn't have the full hood on her head. So you'd see her hair with glasses,
Yeah,
but
I think I remember that. Yeah. I definitely like the costume. I think the costume is very interesting looking. But
I like it too.
you can see it definitely is I mean, there was a lot of influence, I think, of Punisher here, even down to their white boots.
Well, there's in the history of comics, you'll always see Marvel and DC taking success from one and then putting it in their own twist.
Oh, for sure.
I mean, they constantly do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but this was good. I enjoyed
Yeah,
it.
it sounded like a pretty interesting plot for one issue. It just seems like there was a lot going on.
Sounds like they didn't leave you a cliffhanger either. It was
No,
done in
this was
one
it.
right
One
there.
and one. Yep.
Yeah.
Sounds like a good first issue.
Yeah, it really brought you into the character and understood. I mean, you know exactly what you're going to get with this book.
Cool.
You want to go next, Chris?
Sure, I'll do a kind of might be like a shorter one. I did another I read another issue of that Justice Society America 1991 miniseries, I think it was. Yeah, 1991. And this one, the last one I talked about last time, was featuring the Flash. This one's featuring Black Canary, and it's called The Sack of Gotham. And the same writer as last time, Lance Straczynski, but different artist, Grant Meem. Do you guys know him? I don't.
I
I feel like
don't.
I've seen his name, but I don't remember.
Doesn't sound familiar.
Yeah. Spelled Meehm. But anyways, it seems like the art on this miniseries was sort of all over the place. This Grant Meem does some more work later on, but they have a few different artists. I like the art a little bit better on issue one, but this art is still enjoyable. He does the inks as well, and I think he inks himself a little too heavily, in my opinion. I think maybe the art would a little bit better if he had a little lighter touch on that. But the
It's a
I don't
beautiful
think he.
cover, though. I like the way he drew Black Canary,
Yeah, it's a
for
cool
sure.
cover. I don't know if he. I think the cover's by. I think cover's by Tom Lyle, though. I think it's by somebody else.
Yeah, it looks like Lyle.
Yeah, it's got Black Canary with Solomon Grundy creeping up behind her, and there's some Egyptian artifacts and stuff. And
Born
unlike
on a
some
Monday.
covers,
He's born on a
yep,
Monday.
he was. So tomorrow's his birthday.
I keep forgetting today's not Saturday, damn it, because I worked yesterday. I threw my whole freaking week off.
Yeah, my wife worked yesterday. Even though I didn't work, it just made it seem like it wasn't a Saturday because she wasn't around, so
Yeah.
it threw me off a little, not as much as if I worked, but
I worked too, but I have to put that in like quotes because there wasn't a lot of work to be done, which was
For
made
me, it
it
was like extremely busy, so it was like I just wanted to get out of there. 'Cause man, as I get older, when I was younger, it was so much easier. And now it's like I cherish my weekend. I like cherish it every second. 'Cause I read. And I do things I enjoy.
It's your comic
So,
book time.
yeah. Go ahead. She almost looks kind of like an Asian influence there on the cover. Doesn't she?
Yeah, I can see that how they drew her face.
Yeah.
So actually the first Justice League member you see in this comic is not Black Canary, but or I said yeah, Justice Society rather. It's actually Alan Scott, but in his other identity, in his civilian identity, we see him on a television screen in a furniture display, furniture store display window. And he's reporting on the fact that they're having intermittent power failures around Gotham City before some hoodlums smash open the display window. They're taking advantage of the power outage and doing some looting. But unfortunately for them, the fishnet wearing superheroine shows up and starts physically reprimanding them for their activities, and also verbally reprimands them for taking advantage of the situation. And she's got a police scanner on her motorcycle, so actually she's taking care of them and roped them to a telephone pole for the cops. She hears that there's a burglary in progress at the Gotham Museum of Natural History, which is nearby. So she heads over to try to help out with that and finds the guards and even a police car overturned out front and an officer that is in rough shape. The guard inside, the security officer, his neck has been broken. So she starts making her way through. You know, there's no power in the city, so she's got a flashlight out, and she's slowly making her way through the Treasures of Ancient Egypt exhibit. And she comes across the crooks that are trying to swipe something from the exhibit. See another action scene. It's actually a pretty action-packed issue in terms of there's a lot of there's enough dialogue, 'cause there's a lot of quipping going on, and they are using thought balloons. So there's a lot of thought balloons from Black Canary, which kind of could have been a good choice, 'cause like I said, there's a lot of action. But so she takes on the thieves, which not too much trouble for her, and she's checking out what they seem to have been interested in, and she looks at it's the Egyptian crown that's depicted on the cover, Egyptian style gold crown with a cobra on the front of it, and she's wondering what the hell's going on because there's no way that they could actually sell the item, get money for it, because it's real well known. Anybody that they took it to would know that it's hot. She looks at the inscription, and it's a crown of Cheops or Cheops. I'm not sure how you would say that. Circa 2000 BC, thought to be the favorite headdress of Cheops, Egyptian pharaoh, builder of the Great Pyramid, an astrologer as well as a ruler. Cheops was said to be the originator of the worship of celestial beings, and the mentor of Ptolemy, the first astronomer. So I mean that's featured in one panel, so that does draw your attention to it. But if you didn't stop to take a look at that, you could kind of sort of miss out on how this ties into the overall plot. But fortunately for Black Canary, but as we're kind of expecting because of the cover, Solomon Grundy shows up, and he starts, he's a bit of a brutish fellow, starts laying in on Black Canary, and there's a guy with him that's warning him not to to be careful, not to damage the treasure in the process. But after spending all that time with Black Canary, we switch over to a different scene, and we connect back to the first story where Ted Knight, Starman, is wheelchair bound and being held captive at the observatory. And as far as he knows, the Flash failed last time to stop the electrical being, and that Ryan character, who's now absorbed all of the electrical power, and that is why the blackout is occurred in Gotham and actually across the country. And so Ted's blaming himself. Ted's in a pretty bad place. And the guy that's holding him captive, who's still sort of in shadows, he takes off a fake beard disguise, and he takes Ted's star rod, that uses as Starman, and which is another thing that makes Ted feel responsible. But this he goes up to the observatory and he shoots the star rod into the sky, and this being, it's not quite clear to me what's going on here, if his the star rod causes a constellation to come to life. But he yells, "Behold, Sagittarius!" And there's this celestial-looking character with a bow and stars across his chest. It's all kind of made out of golden starlight. But back to the museum, and for several pages, Black Canary was really just kind of a relying on her martial arts, is trying to get the better of Solomon Grundy and not become too injured himself. She finally kind of gets the better of him by dropping down and rolling and using his momentum to throw him out the window of the museum, and the impact of falling a couple stories into the alleyway seems to knock him out. So she jumps down pretty excited that she's going to be able to tell the guys at the JSA that she was able to take on and knock out Solomon Grundy when she gets close to him, and he stops playing possum or recovers enough that he grabs her and throws her brutally into the nearby wall. And she's able to accept or escape what might have been death by grabbing a couple trash can lids and banging them on either side of his head. But she, as she crawls away, she thinks to herself that her ribs might be broken from that last attack. The police show up, and she actually gets thrown again by Grundy as the police take fire on him. But as we might expect, it doesn't really do a whole lot. But things are interrupted when the power all of a sudden seems to go back on. At least there's all of a sudden there's a lot of light, and Grundy is distracted enough that he starts to walk away from Canary. She's not going to let him go that easily, and tries to jump on his back. But as she does, she realizes that Grundy's saying something about Lantern. She looks up. She's like, "Oh my God, the world's gone crazy. We still haven't seen what they're looking at." And because she's distracted, she gets hit in the back of the head with a sap by a couple crooks that come up from behind. And then we finally As she's knocked out and they plan to cart her off with the rest of the stuff that they're taking, we see on the last page finally what they were looking at, and up in the sky, now in his superhero garb as Green Lantern, Alan Scott is shouting, "Back off, Bowman. This is my livelihood you're messing with." So the Sagittarius fellow that we saw in the interlude is opposing him, and the Green Lantern is defending the radio tower, that hence the reference to his livelihood. So next issue, the cover star will be Green Lantern, and like I said, as my intro, it wasn't there was definitely competent. Didn't quite stand up to, I think it was Rick Bruchette on the first issue, but Bruchette doesn't really come back as a penciler. It looks like he just does inking later on, so maybe he just wasn't able to keep up.
Is it similar style though? Because you had
It's pretty.
Parabek and the other guy kind of doing like an animated cartoon look, I guess you could say.
Right.
Is this
Yeah.
guy following in the same vein or is he totally different?
No, it's not totally different. It's definitely in the same vein. It's not a harsh transition. Whether he's mimicking or his style just happens to be similar, it really is. It's not that bad. If I just had to choose one over the other, I would choose the art in issue one. But it's still decent. Definitely doesn't detract from the story at all. It doesn't pop in quite the same way as issue one, where I would say, where it's like, I gotta look up more about this guy or anything, but definitely nothing to complain about. And it was a fast read. Maybe not as fast as if the story was told today and with the same plot, because like I said, there's a lot of thought bubbles and dialoguing going on. But well choreographed fights between Grundy and Canary, even though it took up a lot of the issue. So the plot overall doesn't move forward a ton, but pretty interesting fight considering they're kind of mismatched in power levels. So you get into seeing how Canary is gonna, handle Grundy one on one. So yeah, pretty good.
Yeah, cool. I need to revisit these at some point because man, I don't remember them, even though I know I read them.
Yeah.
I do like the covers,
Yeah.
like a lot.
Oh,
So,
and I did sorry, I did look up what X-Men annual that was. It was number 13 for, so everyone out there holding their breath can
holding
finally
their
relax.
let their breath go.
Yeah, it was the Lannis Attacks, with art by Mark Bagley, actually. Who I really didn't know from Adam at the time, but
He's a fast artist. He could do a lot.
yeah.
And
I
he's
like his
good.
son.
I like him too. My first I think was Thunderbolts and then Ultimate Spider-Man. So my choice was driven by two things. It was driven by me reading for another podcast I'll be doing, which is it was Batgirl, which is the current Batgirl. And then it was also driven by I felt like reading some Black Canary. So it's kind of funny that we have like this communication skill in our brain that like when you pick something I seem to be navigating to, Chris. So I'm gonna go with this first. I read Birds of Prey 88 and 89. This is Oracle. And I just love the way Gail Simone writes Barbara Gordon. Like to me, it's some of the best Barbara Gordon I've ever read. And I think she really gets the character. And this just barely makes the cutoff date. The cover. I'm going to talk about 88 and 89, which is January and February of 2006. I'm pushing the 10-year boundary, but the 88 was amazing. It has a Adriana Mello cover, and I know her from Witchblade because I've read a lot of Witchblade, and the interiors are done by Bennett, which Joe Bennett's done a lot of art for DC. Most recently, I think it was Hawkman, but he has a really good art style. But this is part two and three of the War with Calculator. And this is like the Calculator that was no joke. This is like after Meltzer, Brad, and Identity Crisis decided the Calculator was going to be like the Oracle for the villains. And Oracle had taken out some satellites the Calculator needed. So he sends Hellhound and the Spider, who have both been in Batman books. And I think they've been in Nightwing books. Hellhound is a weird guy. He like trains dogs to attack and stuff. So the fact that he does that, and I'm a dog lover, I just want him to get thrown out a window. But like, I just throw this fucker out the window. But they capture Savant, and Mr. Savant and Mr. Creote were characters early on in this series that became a really big part of this book, and they became allies with Oracle, and they started working as like part of Birds of Prey. Well, they capture him to try to reveal where Oracle is kept for Calculator, and they start beating him brutally. And meanwhile, this has Huntress, Helena, and Dinah, Oracle going out and just shopping, which is really cool because Helena says, I'm on a teacher's salary. I can't afford to go shopping. And Barbara basically puts her on payroll, and she says, don't worry about it, and she could buy anything she wants. So what's really cool is she's financially stable and supporting the people that work under her. And one of the first places they go for some reason is this place called Carson's Collectibles. And Black Canary walks in and sees all these action figures of DC characters. And she looks at she asks the person, how many do you have of these Black Canary figures? And it's Black Canary in the Justice League International suit. And she hates that suit. and the one says, we have a whole box of those. She said the ones with the fishnet sold out on the first day. So I thought that was really cool. That was a really cool shout out, you know. And Barbara Gordon goes into a computer shop. She buys all this cool computer equipment, and all these geeks are like really turned on by her and trying to ask on a date and stuff. And what they're planning on doing next is taking out like the mafioso in Gotham and stuff. And what they want to do is place Helena, because she's got that mafia background. I mean, her father was from the mafia, and she has that background. They want to put her in place and in control of the mafia and use her to control things. And it's pretty cool because this has the reunion of Black Canary and Green Arrow, and I just love their relationship. Like, I know Ollie did bad things. Like, he cheated on her and stuff, but like he loves her so much. I mean, he makes mistakes, and that's what's magical about Ollie is he's very human. He makes a lot of mistakes, and this was a big mistake because they had such a great relationship going back to the Justice League days. And a lot of it's told through Black Canary's dialogue boxes as they're fighting a place that the mafia is in Star City is holding up as a hog farm where they brutally do hogs, but it's also a mafia front. That seems to be in Sopranos too. I remember there was a pork restaurant in the front. But,
oh yeah.
Yeah.
I always hang out there.
Sexualities or something.
Yeah, yeah. So I guess they're really into pork. But they go in here and they have this huge fight scene, and Ollie notices that Black Canary her fighting techniques is like really brutal and stuff. And the cool dialogue is she's like saying, you know, he cheated on me and I feel bad about this and I know I can never be with him, but I love him so much. I mean, she loves Ollie so much. And she like flashes back. She says, he was rude, arrogant, pushy, preachy, and vain. I liked him right away. First guy ever to cuss openly in a JLA meeting. He had me right there. First guy ever I saw to dare to tell Hawkman to shut the hell up. And after the worst day of my life, this goes back to Green Arrow Longbow Hunters, where they like cut her throat and did stuff to her. It says, after the worst day of my life being caught and assaulted by, I don't even want to think about it. After that day, he was the kindest, most caring man in the world. I wrapped myself up in him. Then he cheated on me. So it like, and everything just went black. It was like, her whole life changed, and this was the man she loved, and they cannot be together. So it's really emotional and an amazing story, but you could see the love between them, and Gail Simone does an amazing job. And meanwhile, Helena goes over and convinces the people she knows in the mafia to side over with her, but she has to do it through fighting and beating up some guys, and so they actually take control. And then the second issue is just them brutalizing Savant some more, Calculator trying to find out where she is. But it also has a really emotional scene because during these issues, Barbara started to get feeling back in her toes. Like several issues ago, she was able to wiggle her toes. Just she's like, am I going to be able to walk again? So she's like getting therapy, and her dad is like, you know, Commissioner Gordon is like, he's like so optimistic. He thinks she's going to walk again. And it's a really emotional scene because she takes him up to the tower and she says, Dad, this is who I am. And she says, hey, I'm Oracle. Yeah, so it's a really key issue there. And then she also pulls out of the closet. She pulls out her Batgirl suit. And he says, oh, I knew about that. I didn't know about I didn't know that you were Oracle, but I knew you were Batgirl. And she goes, God, I wish I could have told you so many things if you knew that. You know, so it's like a really, really awesome scene and such so well told. And then Helena and them are actually going after to get Savant back from being tortured. And they do rescue him, and they find out that Hive's involved as well. And they free Savant, and she's trying to Oracle's trying to keep Savant and Mr. Creote from killing people because that's not in their motto. But as soon as he gets free after being tortured for weeks, he grabs Spider and throws him out the window. While that happens, Calculator tells Deathstroke, who's outside with the sniper, basically pointed right at him. He's like, take her out, because he had called Barbara, says, if you free my satellites right now, I will not send my guys anymore after you. And he basically said, I haven't heard back from her, so go ahead and kill her. So that's how it cliffhangs. And it shows Batman on the back panel, so he's involved now too. But these issues were just like, knock it out of the park, fucking awesome. And I was like, yeah, it was just awesome. Awesome shit. It reminded me why I love these characters so much.
That's cool.
And the other thing that was really interesting is historical. This is a thing that I don't remember, but Black Canary was learning all these skills from Lady Shiva. And what's really weird about this is that it mentions that Shiva would never physically go train her. She would just send her a packet in the mail that says, you need to have a diet like this. Here's some moves you need to practice on. And she was like doing like a Weight Watchers with Lady Shiva training. So I thought that was absolutely fascinating too. So I was like, this book had it all. It had it.
She was doing remote learning.
Yeah, it was amazing 2 issues. Birds of Prey 88 and 89 by Gail Simone. So good stuff.
Very nice.
Cool.
So, Rob, you're up.
Oh, okay. That's right. Okay. So, the other book that I was going to cover today, I read, I don't know, about a week or so ago. maybe a couple weeks ago. It's Geomancer number one from Valiant. And cool. I had just happened upon, I think, like three issues. I think it was like four. It only ran eight issues. I think I bought like four, five, or six. I found at the flea market a few years ago, and I read those. And then I went ahead, and as I was starting to try to get more old Valiant stuff, I bought the rest of this run. So I read one through eight over the course of just a couple days because they're pretty quick reads. I was warned that this was that the whole run was pretty bad. I didn't think it was all that bad, honestly. I think that they were just trying to fit a lot of different things in there, and they probably found out a few months, you know, ahead that it was going to be canceled. So then they kind of jammed stuff in at the end to try to wrap things up. But honestly, I thought this first issue was pretty entertaining. The writer is Maurice, I think it's pronounced Fontenot. I think it's French. And Rags Morales was the penciler. So
okay. I love his art.
Oh, yeah.
My wife doesn't like it.
Really?
Well, one of the books I had, Barb doesn't read much comics, but she read Identity Crisis. She loved it, and she loves Brad Meltzer, one of my mm-hmm. favorite. She didn't like the art. And
yeah,
I was like,
I like his art. Yeah.
How could you not like this? There's so much emotion and facial structure and stuff in it.
Yeah, and this is, you know, obviously a little bit older. This was from 94. And, of course, it's got the chromium cover, right? So it's definitely a 90s book.
Well, having said that, I want to just talk a little bit about that.
Sure.
Those chromium covers were so much better than the new VEI chromium covers.
Yeah, why is that?
By a landslide. Those ones seem – the new ones seem very muted, where the old ones, they seemed like bright and shiny and glossy and awesome.
They
are.
I just
wanted to comment on that.
They are. I mean, they're beautiful covers. And this is a beautiful cover. It's a wraparound cover. It's got the new Geomancer on the front beating up some zombies. And on the back, it's got the Eternal Warrior grabbing one zombie by the neck and slashing another one with his spikes on his hand with the other hand. And yeah, it's great.
Fist and steel, baby.
Fist and steel. So this one, they all opened up with a tale from the Book of the Geomancer. And this one's showing something from 1192 AD. And basically it's got Galad fighting a monk. And as you start reading about it, it turns out that this monk has been possessed by the immortal enemy. And Micah, I read quite a bit of Valiant back in the 90s, but I didn't read this, and I didn't know that Immortal Enemy was not a new creation for the Valiant. I didn't realize that this was around back in the 90s.
Right, yeah.
So
not nearly to me as creepy as they made him in the Valiant, though.
Oh my God, no.
Because
he
reminded me of that fucker in Poltergeist 2.
Like, oh yeah.
I mean, if I had to cast anybody, I would cast that guy, because he was – I mean, that guy was just creepy.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Down to like the suit and the little hat and stuff.
Everything, you know.
Yeah, so, you know, the first few pages kind of detail this fight with Galad against the this monk who's been possessed by the immortal enemy, and they're going back and forth, and another monk who is the Geomancer is going to become – I think he actually is the Geomancer. He starts helping Galad, and he sets the immortal enemy on fire, and they take care of the immortal enemy, and he's dead for now, but they know that he's immortal. He'll come back someday. And then it cuts back to this Geomancer monk who he's now very, very old, and he's writing in his book saying his time's almost done, and that the Geomancers that will follow will have to learn from this book, and this is his final message, and so on and so forth. And he's not there to actually train a new Geomancer, but they're going to have to learn from this book. And then he passes away. So then it shows Brooklyn, New York, 1994. It has a couple cops getting out of a cop car going into a convenience store. And they're chatting with each other. And then somebody says to one of the cops, Underwood, is that you? And I said, well, I'll be. It's Clay McHenry. And Clay McHenry's there shopping, and he's a blind ex-cop. And they're just chatting a little, and you can tell that they really don't get along very, very well. I'm not sure what exactly that's all about, but Clay McHenry says, you know, one advantage to being blind is I don't have to look at your faces anymore. See you later. So you can tell they're not getting along, and the cops start following McHenry out of there and actually trip him, make him fall down. It's kind of strange. You're like, okay, what's going on there? You don't know, but the cop says, I'll be watching you, Clay, you and your gimp partner. So you're wondering what's up with that. You see Clay walking up the stairs to his rundown apartment, and he's thinking to himself, saying that he was a decorated police officer, and then he was a cop on the take. So you're like, okay, well, what's going on here? He says, I was young and happy. I had a good job in the forest, a nice house. Samantha, that's his wife. He said, but I destroyed myself. Everything I loved, did the best to tear apart. So he's just holding his head in his hands on his bed, just basically distraught, pulls out a revolver from under his bed and holds it up to his head and saying that there's nothing for him, nothing, and he starts crying. And then he just throws the gun away saying that, you know, I'm a coward. Suddenly, who walks into the room but the Eternal Warrior? It says, Clay McHenry, you're the uncle of – is it Joff or Jeff McHenry? You guys know? Mike, do you know? Is it Joff?
You know what I used to say? I used to say the same when I read comics back in the day. I used to say Joff, but it's Jeff.
Yeah, I thought it was Joff. I always said Joff, but I believe that's just another way to spell Joff, right?
Yeah, it's kind of like Eric. I always say Arik.
I still say Arik.
I will not say Eric.
No.
But it is Jeff.
All right, I'm going to call him Jeff.
As a matter of fact, I'm seeing more people like, you know, coworkers and stuff with their names spelled like Jeff Johns, you know, Jeff.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause so. I know that. Yeah. Yeah. All right. So I'll call him Jeff too. So he said, you're the uncle of Jeff McHenry. And he said, what are you doing in my house? And Eternal Warrior says, you're the last one on my list, McHenry. I've heard a lot about you. Not much of it's good, but the earth doesn't lie. So you could be the one. And he says, reach out and take hold of this book. So he's got the book of the Geomancer, and Clay McHenry grabs it, and He's all of a sudden his mind's open to all the different people, the men and women who have been the Geomancer in the past. And he's just totally overwhelmed and falls to the ground. And Galad, you know, tells him that he has the sight. And he said, I'm the fist and steel of the earth. I'm the protector, and the earth's chosen you to be its next Geomancer. From that there, it cuts to a penthouse apartment in Manhattan. It's got this creepy looking guy with this robe on, and you can, without even knowing anything, I'm automatically assuming that this is going to be like the new immortal enemy. And he's got all these dead bodies around him. And he goes ahead and he brings them to like a zombie state. He says, serve your new master now. So he's brought all these zombies back to life and calls two of them. They're called Vice and Nitro. He said, you're bringing the book back to me. So apparently these were Master Dark's minions before, because he said that they failed Dark twice before, but you're not going to fail me. So he wants this Book of the Geomancer. Cuts back to Galad and Clay a few hours later, and they're talking a little bit. They've managed to get Buck McHenry's pack, which has all sorts of different stuff in it. And Buck McHenry was a Geomancer before Jeff was, and so he's grabbing different things, and they're all the things are kind of, like, kind of talking to him, and he goes ahead and he grabs this like bandana that has all these symbols on it, and he's like, okay, I'm gonna wear this, and puts that on instead of his baseball hat. And basically they're kind of arguing, because Galad doesn't believe that Clay McHenry has what it takes to be the Geomancer, and he's only there because he's heard from the earth, and the earth is saying that that Clay's going to be a geomancer, but Gilad just can't seem to believe it because he's kind of going through everything that Clay McHenry's been through, saying, you know, basically, I got information from a friend of mine on the force, and said that your name's popped up all these times in internal investigations on police corruption. It's like you were blinded, your partner was paralyzed in an illegal transaction, so on and so forth. He's like, I really don't think that you're going to be a very honorable geomancer. He's like, but, you know, I've got to give you the benefit of the doubt for now, but I'm not expecting much. So they kind of they decide to go up to a hospital where Clay's ex-partner is. He's been paralyzed, and Clay goes up to see him, and they're just chatting, and he's like, you know, we're partners to the end. He's like, I don't blame you for what happened. It was fate. It was meant to be. And Clay's like, yeah, this is crazy. I'm blind. You're paralyzed. He's like, I just had to come and see you. And he leaves the room, and Gilad is like, you're responsible for that man being crippled, aren't you? It's like, you don't have any honor at all. I don't think you're geomancer material. And it's going to take a lot to convince me. And the Clay McHenry says, fine, just give me the book and I'm out and get out of here. I'm the one. He's like, no way. He's like, you've got a lot to learn. You're not the geomancer yet. And he's like, there's a lot more to it than just hearing the Earth talk to you. And then suddenly all these spirit, well, they look like zombies. All these zombies just like appear because they walked out of the hospital and just like out of the ground. So they're surrounded and these spirits are trying to get the book. So Clay's just swinging his cane around, his blind man's cane, and just by luck, he's just hitting stuff, and the zombies are falling apart, and now he's just getting overwhelmed. Gilad is trying to dispatch them as fast as he can, and Gilad has the actual pack that has the book in it at this point. Clay's swinging his cane around some more and can't focus on anything, but he's knocking a few out. But now a couple of the other ones have knives, and they get Clay pretty badly. Cut him a few times, and he's in pretty bad shape. He falls over, and just as one of the zombies is about to land a killing blow, Gilad knocks him off of Clay and knocks him down, and the book is on the ground. They're trying to get to it, and Gilad dispatches the last two zombies, that Vice and I forget what the other one was called, but it was the two main zombies that they were naming before, Nitro. So we get rid of those, and Gilad turns around and plays on the ground coughing, and he's in bad shape. It's like, I got the book. It's like, but I think I'm dying. And Galad's like, no, you can't quit on me. I don't know if you have what it takes, but it's too late to turn back now. We're not going to lose you like we lost Jeff. And he doesn't really say what happened to Jeff, but apparently he was like lost in the time stream. So hours later, you see Gilad just digging a hole. And Clay McHenry's like, what are you doing? He's like, I'm saving you. He's like, you got it. There's an ancient geomancer ritual of regeneration. It's only chance of surviving. And basically he puts him down in the ground, buries him. And Gilad says, I'll see you on the other side, geomancer. So he calls him geomancer. And Clay thinks, no, I don't want to die. And then it just cuts to black, and that's the end of the first issue. So there's a lot going on with this issue. I actually did enjoy it. Like I said,
people sounds like a fantastic issue to me. What's wrong with those guys in Live Ivar's long box? What's
wrong? I thought it was great. I really, like I said, I mean, there was a lot of backstory with this guy. He's obviously had a lot of mistakes in his life. He's no longer with his wife. He's still in love with his wife, but he's no longer with her.
Yeah.
He's blind man. He's caused, you know, an injury to an ex-partner. He's got cops that are not happy with him. You're not getting a lot yet. as to whether or not these cops are up and up and up cops or they were also on the take. You're not knowing that yet, but you've got the immortal enemy is back trying to get this book. And at the end, you're like, okay, it looks like this geomancer is, is he going to survive or not? I mean, this is the first issue. I'm feeling he's probably going to survive, but he's mortally wounded. He's going to
only be for eight left. Issues. No.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, at least the publishing wise, right?
Yeah. But I thought it was a really good introduction. I've read all eight issues at this point, so I know where it went. And I mean, I will admit that as it got farther on, it tried to do a lot of different things all at once, and that I think it suffered for kind of being all over the place. But I think that part of that was probably, okay, we're not going to publish this anymore. We have to wrap this up. So he's trying to wrap it up as best as he
could. Yeah, and you'll see that in a lot of books.
Right.
A lot of books that we see that we absolutely love that don't stand a chance sales-wise. You see like them start off like with this big epic, this has so much potential. And then you say, wow, because they cram it in and they try to like – They make it end way before its time, mm-hmm.
I mean, if this book
it doesn't seem as good as it started, but
that's exactly it. If this book could have gone, let's say it would have gone 20 issues.
Yeah.
There was a lot that they could have done with this in terms of just his personal life, the whole corruption aspect with the cops, and then all of the, the supernatural stuff as being the geomancer and, going against the immortal enemy, learning how to be the geomancer. I mean, they had to do all of that in eight issues, and it suffered for that. But this first issue and the next couple issues I thought were really, really well done. And it was interesting to read after the fact, knowing that, okay, I've only got eight issues to read this. And because I, like I said, I read this in 2 days. So I read I read three issues in one day and five in the second. But I really enjoyed this debut issue, and I thought that they could have done a lot more with this character had he been maybe a little bit more successful, and the sales would have been there to offer more issues.
Yeah, that was very cool.
Yeah, I liked it.
I liked it at the time. I haven't revisited, but I'm pretty good at like shifting. Like I don't compare a 90s book to today's book, and I don't compare today's book to a 90s book because it. I remember those times very differently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then when I get into something that is before I was born, I try to shift my brain into that time period.
Mm-hmm.
Like I try to think of what did kids do at this time to get a comic book? What did they, what was the technology like? What was this, So it helps me enjoy books from any time period.
Yeah.
At a high level.
Yesterday I was reading, I read a couple from one of those Craig Yeo books, the hardcover. And it was some ghost gallery entries from old Jumbo comics from the early 50s. And to just take it objectively, to just say, okay, just read this without any context, you could say, well, these are kind of silly. But to know that these are like 50, like you have to have that mindset. You have to put yourself into like, okay, these were coming out in like 1952. Let's read this with an open mind. And it's really, really fun to read some of that older stuff.
It is. I like what he does with, I have a few of the ones. I don't know if I have the exact ones you do.
Mm-hmm.
I have a few of the hardcovers, but I do buy the romance ones monthly because romance comics I get a big kick out of because it tells me historically what thick times were like a lot,
Yeah, by kick, yeah. He means a boner.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty cool. I get a boner and I read my Craig Yeo books.
There you go.
All right, Chris. You're next in the queue, my friend.
Okay, the other thing I was going to talk about is my Kid the Flash installment for this time. I'm going to do just a couple issues of New Teen Titans. Last time I was talking about how Marv Wolfman and George Perez. Now, with issue two, they introduced a very prominent character in Deathstroke and wrapped that storyline up. With issue three, they bring back a villain, but in the process of doing so, they do introduce a bunch of new characters as well. And New Teen Titans issue three has Dr. Light on the cover, and he's the one to return. He was initially a Justice League of America villain and was one of the few bigger actual supervillains to appear in the original Teen Titans Volume 1. It was towards the end in the 40s, issue number 40s, that he opposed the team. They didn't face a lot of supervillains, and they didn't usually face that many villains of the Justice League, but he was one of the few. So right early on here, it's only about 5 years later from that appearance that Dr. Light comes back, and so he's faced some of the team before. The story is called The Fearsome Five in reference to the fact that he's now recruited a team of his own, and those are the new characters, a lot of whom have become familiar, have even been used on the Teen Titans cartoon, and they all make their first appearance here. Specifically, you have the brother and sister Mammoth and Shimmer, the little guy Gizmo, and Simon, the telekinetic guy. And they're kind of meeting each other for the first time. So Dr. Light has recruited them. And especially in the case of Simon, they will very quickly start. It's not a team that Dr. Light leads very successfully, I'll put it that way. That the they definitely have a lot of inner quabbles, and Simon quickly... He's intellect, so he's very quickly makes a play for leadership of the team. But Dr. Light wants revenge for being defeated before, and he's heard that there's a new Teen Titans, apparently. So he's put together his own team to go after them. Meanwhile, I mean, the team doesn't, you know, the four of them know each other pretty well, and then they've got three new members. And now that Starfire speaks English, she is getting to know them better. And it's always kind of fun to go back and see these characters get acquainted for the first time. They're hanging out, and Starfire is kind of telling them about her planet and her situation. They'll become a lot more familiar to them, just her history with being sold into slavery and all that. And then... So Raven shows up. She is not amongst them, and as she is has the habit of doing in these early issues, she pops in a cloud of smoke and tells them there's an emergency and doesn't really explain anything. And you know, everything's very urgent for Raven, and she doesn't really, ironically being an empath, she doesn't really spend a lot of time thinking about how her actions are affecting the others around her, because she's so concerned with the threat of her father. But Dick Grayson, you know, he's a leader and wants things to be organized, and so he tries to pin her down for a second, verbally, that is, not physically. And and he said, you know, before you take another step, I want to know who you are. And he's looking for answers. And we see more of what we were talking about last time with Wally, where he is under the spell of Raven. And so he actually, it's gotten even worse, where he yells, "Leave her alone. How dare you even question, how dare you question her?" And he actually, at high speed, punches Robin across the face. And given that he is using high speed, it knocks Dick flat and into some kind of furniture or something. And it's actually Raven that even though she's kind of the cause of the problem here, she's the one that actually tells Wallace, as she calls him, that Richard is his friend. So try to get things cooled down. Meanwhile, our villains are approaching an attack. Cyborg's not around either. We'll see what he's up to. So it's 6-on-5, and I won't go into detail on the fight here too much, but suffice to say that things end with Shimmer using her element powers to change in environment to ether, and the team all passes out. The Titans do. But then moments later, the Fearsome Five are outside, and Gizmo's catching up to the other four. He says, "What the heck are you doing? We had them. Why are we leaving?" And Light reveals that none of them really know why they left when they had the Titans basically beaten. That something force them out of there, at least according to Light, that he doesn't understand, though Simon is smiling. Then we have one of several throughout the next few issues scenes well, we haven't actually seen Raven's father, Trigon, in the full. She has a lot of conversations with him, sort of. He just appears as like a star in the sky or in the demonic realm. It's a lot of times there's one-sided conversations where she's trying to convince him not to attack the dimension that Earth is in. We see what Cyborg's up to. He's having some more. He's having a conversation with his father, who's got a lot of friction with, who he blames for the condition that he's in. Cyborg finds a letter that he's invited to the opening of the Titan's Tower, and it appears like he's not the only one that got that invitation, as we see Beast Boy is the first to show up. And sure enough, somebody built them a headquarters, which would be a rather iconic headquarters for a superhero team. So the team arrives, and Wally shows up. He's kind of taken a spin around the place at super speed to try to figure things out, and everything is clean, even the dust. Even there's not even a lot of dust, but they're still suspicious of what's going on. Yet again, Raven shows up, coming back from the demonic realm, and we have kind of a repeat of the earlier scene where Robin warns her that she better not go anywhere until she actually gives them some answers instead of just popping in and out and trying to tell them what to do. And Wally once again puts his hand on his shoulder and tells him, "I warned you before." And again, it's Raven who tells Wally to calm down. And she admits that she's given them not a lot of reason to trust them. And so she does finally tell them, not a lot, but or not everything, but she does tell them that she had seen. She doesn't tell them it's her father, but she has seen that Trigon has his eyes on their dimension, and specifically on the planet Earth, and Justice League has fought some of the demons that he has already sent. And the reason that she sent them into battle earlier against the Fearsome Five is that somehow that they are some there's some kind of link between them and Trigon that she's not really uncertain of. But she actually wants she's actually tried to get the Justice League involved. And for some reason, the Fearsome Five want the Titans to fight the Justice League, and obviously the team's like, well, we're not going to fight them in the first place because we're on the same side, but why would we, who are not that experienced, go up against the Justice League? And tells them that she doesn't understand why, but for some reason it's in their interest. So she's kind of have these precognitive moments that don't really explain everything, and so it's not very satisfying to those that she tells it about. Meanwhile, the Fearsome Five are also, you know, Light's convincing, trying to convince the others to go up against the Justice League as well. Simon reveals, you know, like, well, if the Justice League are the problem, why were we going up against the Titans? And Simon reveals that it's because they're my problem, and everything that's been going on so far has been my plan. Simon's really the one that kind of orchestrated things to put the team together, almost in a way similar to the way that Raven has, even though they sort of have different intentions. And that is kind of the connection there between Simon, or between these teams, is that Simon was sort of created, really. He was just sort of a normal guy, a physicist, was given his powers by Trigon. And he was given his mission. So he saw that Dr. Light was looking for a team. He saw his opportunity to infiltrate that team and take care of it himself, or take over it himself. So he used his telekinetic powers then to call out to the Titans and to beckon them out. Everyone's like up for the fight pretty much, basically. And Raven says that she's going to stay behind. And Wally, deep in the throes here of the spell that's on him, says that if she's staying, so is he. And reason Raven staying behind is because she thinks the battle with the Fearsome Five is pretty much useless. They need to spend their time convincing the Justice League to go up against Trigon. So five of the Titans head off to face the Fearsome Five. And once again, the battle does not go very well. Simon takes out Wonder Girl with his powers, and Robin, having been knocked into, I guess maybe the New York River, or the Hudson rather, comes out of the water onto the dock, only to find himself knocked out by Mammoth. So Raven, with her abilities, she knows that things haven't gone very well. She's like, you know, we're going to have to help them out whether we want to or not. So I guess because Raven's asking, Wally speeds off, comes upon a scene where Cyborg and Robin are knocked out, and Starfire is blasting Mammoth with her bolts. Wally's not much help at first, because he just kind of goes flying into Mammoth's body. And, you know, this is, well, the second time that they've faced each other, so they're still kind of getting to know each other's powers and everything. Beast Boy comes in, looks like things maybe are going to turn the tides, and Wally comes in for another go, but Simon, with the cooperation of Mammoth, they're able to cause Kid Flash to slow down before he gets to Mammoth. So, or actually what happens is that Simon takes over control of Mammoth's body, and so he's able to knock out Kid Flash without even really being able to be able to see him. So things for issue 3 end on kind of an ominous note, and And that's what draws us into issue four, which has the iconic cover of the Justice League of America versus the New Teen Titans. And at least for the JLA, you have Wonder Woman, Hawkman and Atom, Batman, Zatanna, and Green Lantern on the cover. This being like the satellite era of the JLA. And the way that the JLA comes into it is it's actually these mystic beings that are trying to prevent Trigon coming over to our dimension. And it's kind of a misunderstanding because the JLA is getting a reading on them that makes them think that they're evil. And they're also, because it's Raven is the one that's been trying to get them to help, and they're getting Zatanna using her abilities, is getting an evil reading off of Raven. What she's actually detecting is that, is, her parentage, not her own intentions, but the connection that she has to Trigon being her father. And so they're suspicious of her and suspicious of what she's asking them to do. And we get kind of a first good look at Azarath, where Raven's mother is, Arella, and we're introduced to her, and the whole thing that they have going on with pacifism and stuff, that they aren't really willing to help her. And when Raven heads back out of Azarath, she wakes up in Titan's Tower, and she's a bit confused at first because the last time she saw the rest of the team, they were all defeated by the Fearsome Five. She's like, "How are you? How are they all back? How is everybody fine?" She's really distraught that they don't remember everything, and they think that she's possibly going crazy. But she eventually concludes that there's only one answer, that for some reason the Fearsome Five erased their memories and sent them back to Titan's Tower. Well, Wally wants to take the opportunity to try to have a conversation with Raven about everything that's been going on. But unfortunately, there's not a lot of time for that with the imminent arrival of Trigon. So Raven finally tells him a little bit more, and breaks things down about Trigon and how he enslaved this universe, and this dimension that he's in, millions of planets. He had a universe to play with, and then he discovered their universe. And what the Justice League is doing is actually making it easier for him to cross over. And so as soon as she tells us, like, Robin is particularly, all of a sudden is particularly enthusiastic about destroying the Justice League. And Raven's like, "Destroy them? No, that's not what I was trying to do." But it turns out that they had been freed by the Fearsome Five, and that they've been turned into mind control. Their minds have been controlled so that they'll attack the Justice League. And so, all this is kind of a setup for us to get that hero versus hero sort of situation where the Titans actually head up to the JLA satellite, and they let them in because it's the Teen Titans. But as soon as the Teen Titans are let in, they go on the attack, and Kid Flash actually opens things up by spinning his arms and creating a windstorm, which actually does manage to temporarily knock over Wonder Woman, Batman, Green Lantern, the Atom. So they have the obligatory fight, but it is kind of interesting to see Batman and Robin go after each other because of where they're at this point. There is at least some truth, even though he's being mind controlled, there's some truth to Robin's frustration with Batman as his mentor. He says, "Batman, you've been putting me down for months now. It's about time someone turned the tables on you." You know, so we had the fight. Wally doesn't feature too prominently besides things opening up. And things transition into the other realm where the dudes are trying to keep Trigon from showing up. And so the battle spills over into there, and due to the distraction of what's going on with the sorcerers, Trigon does manage to break free. And once again, things end on a fairly ominous note. There's a blast, and as Trigon breaks free, and then both teams kind of wake up from being knocked out. And even though the Titans aren't controlled anymore, things are still kind of there's still a lot of friction. You know, Batman comes down pretty hard on Robin's. You guys better have some kind of an explanation. And Robin retorts with the fact that they're, you know, we're the Titans. We're not some kind of Junior Justice League. And second of all, you big shots really blew it this time. Those sorcerers you were so anxious to get rid of, well, they're trying to stop some creep named Trigon from destroying our world. And because of you self-righteous superheroes, those sorcerers were thwarted. Trigon is free. And so Robin lays in pretty heavy to Batman. You know, they discuss Raven. She, you know, showed up, and we learn about Zatanna checking her out with her magic, but the real bombshell that gets dropped at the end here, especially for Kid Flash, is that because Zatanna has her powers, you know, she criticizes the Titans as a group built on lies, and she drops the bomb that that she used her powers to make Kid Flash think he loves her, so that she would join. And she says, "I'm sorry, Raven, but I had to tell you the truth." And so this is where Wally first has to face the fact that, you know, tell me it's a lie, Raven. And Raven tells him, "I do care for you, but your power was one I desperately needed. Please understand. Please forgive me." And obviously, that's a lot to forgive. And not only Wally, but the rest of the team are pretty put off. And they actually start to walk away from Raven as she pleads with them to not abandon her, that she really does need their help, that they need to believe her. But Wally is hit pretty hard by this, and we'll see in subsequent issues that it's not just as simple as this being revealed, that, you know, what she did still has an effect on him, even with the knowledge that it was done to him. He still struggles with the emotions that it gave him and the feelings that he still has, even though he has this knowledge. And by actually spending time with Raven, it creates a confusion as to whether maybe there are some real feelings that are mixed up in there, and for her as well. So pretty significant plot development for Wally's life, and obviously very iconic issues, as we see in issue 4, the first actual appearance of Trigon on the page. So lots of good work being done by these two creators, and lots of new characters being introduced that have become iconic. And even though, you know, what Kid Flash would eventually make his way out of the book and wasn't a character that Marv Wolfman was crazy about, he has got some pretty significant character development and stuff happening to him early on here. So pretty, needless to say, it's good stuff, but always fun to revisit and see these characters get to know each other.
Yeah. Cool beans. I like that Justice League issue.
Yeah. Yeah, when Jeff Johns did his Titans book, he early on he almost kind of followed like beat by beat in some ways. They were different stories, but he took inspiration almost on an issue by issue basis, at least starting it off. And I'm pretty sure it's Teen Titans number four that he wrote that team goes up against the JLA at that time.
I love that. The Team Titans are some of my favorite. I actually just started reading those again because I bought the trades, so.
Yeah, I really should get those just so I can flip through them more easily, especially with like the first couple of issues. It's not really ones that I should be like pulling out all the time.
Yeah,
Yeah,
they're pretty cheap too. The trades are cheap.
Yeah,
they're like $19.99, and the thing that's cool is they're revisiting things like Deathstroke and Birds of Prey and Batgirl, and right now in the trades, the so they're hitting a lot of older series.
Yeah, I'm glad they're doing that. I picked up the first Birds of Prey collection, and that's cool because it doesn't even like it's all those mini series that before they actually
Yeah,
launched
before
the
they actually
ongoing.
launched the ongoing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, Suicide Squad, Green Arrow, like the Nightwing
Now,
solo
the Suicide
series.
Squads I
They're
got
trading
for
a lot of
sure.
stuff.
The New Teen Titans, I'm missing a few. And because I didn't know that I ordered I ordered like 3 and 4, but didn't order 1 and 2. So I was just looking at Amazon, and I should get them because I'm a completist. It's those damn holes. It's like I was looking at Vigilante, and I skipped the annuals. I have a bad habit for skipping annuals. Even
Yeah,
in New
you do.
Teen Titans, I have a full run, and guess what annual? I'm missing annual number 3.
I was
Is
just
that,
looking, I am too.
and that's the Judas contract, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm missing
Sorry.
I'm notorious for missing annuals.
Yeah.
It just back in the day, I was like, okay, that's the annual. Now, like with current DC, you can't miss the annuals because they're actually part of the story. Like
Yeah, they time right in.
you have to read them. You have to. Very seldom are they a standalone. I mean, they still have some standalone annuals, but mostly they're embedded in as part of the continuity. So you have to get them. So my next book is one of my favorites from one of my favorite titles because it's a Bat Family book. It's Batman Gotham Knights number 45. These books had some of the best covers. It was Brian Boland art. This one features a Man Bat on the cover, or you think it's Man Bat, but I think it's more of his son. So this storyline is called Knights Past, Fathers and Sons, and I had talked about this previously, but it involves a social worker investigator going after Bruce Wayne for the death and mistreatment of Jason Todd. And it's really fascinating story. And Scott Beatty, to me, is like one of the most underrated Batman writers. Like everything that he puts on paper clicks with me. Like I'm like, yes! I'll like read a panel, I'm like, yeah! I just like get excited. I'm like, and then Roger Robinson, he does a fantastic job on pencils. So this team that took over from I think it was Devin Grayson, was really really fantastic. And I like the fact that it merged two storylines that correspond to fathers and sons. So it opens up with Man Bat and his wife talking, Kirk Langstrom talking to his wife saying, we have a son and daughter, and I don't know what to do with their boy because he can't turn back. The daughter can turn, but she can turn human just like the rest of them. And the because I guess they had sex while he had the serum in him, so his kids are infected. And
Which issue is this? This is 45, you said?
yeah, 45, Batman Gotham Knights. It's like part three of the story. So I had covered the other two about the social worker, and this is kind of like building up to the interview. It actually has the interview where the social worker comes to the place. Man, he's so good. This guy is a master at threading storylines. Like Like he did it with Bane being the brother of Bruce Wayne, and he's doing it now with this story arc. He gives you a lot of content in the book, and then he like threads a bunch of little threads in there so he can continue telling stories, and each thread is amazing. This one has that interview, and Bruce Wayne doesn't even show up to the interview. Alfred's just got back from being deadly ill from the legacy virus, like almost dying, and them rescuing him. Oh no, this was not the legacy virus. It was the virus that was in the Bat Cave, and I think it caused by Bat Guano.
Legacy is what killed Colossus, right? That's
yeah. This was well, actually, Batman had a Batman.
Yeah.
You know how they have Nightfall. And a Contagion was the
Contagion, right?
Was the arc that I was looking for. The legacy virus is a mutant virus. So yeah. Maybe Alfred's a mutant, you know? Maybe he is. Maybe you're onto something there. This is like a weird bat guano virus or something going on in the cave.
That's very nasty.
Yeah, but Kirk Langstrom, the boy hears this, and he's starting to feel like an outsider in the family. And even the girl, his sister, rubs him the wrong way. And he, like, knows – the wife is like, you really need to ask Bruce for help. And I guess because of pride, Kirk Langstrom doesn't want to ask him. But the boy knows where the Batcave is. And he like, knows his way into the Batcave. And he's always hanging upside down listening to Bruce and watching him train and all this stuff. And he actually helps Batman in this one. Is he's supposed to be there for the interview, but where Batman was the night before was this is a cool caper, and it has like a basketball thing going on, which I thought was really neat. Is Batman had this incident where this basketball player was kidnapped, and he was borderline college going pro, and what they were trying, and so he went to go rescue the kid. And he captured the guy that had kidnapped him and found out it was the kid's father. And he was ransoming him, just trying to get the bids up higher for the pro teams. So Man-Bat's son helped him help stop him. But he's like, yeah, that was a scam, you know, to try to give him a higher salary by the guys that were bidding on, which I think the basketball team and it's either the basketball team or the football team is Gotham Knights. Maybe they both are. But their pro teams are that in the sports world. So that's kind of ironic. But they have the interview. The guy goes there. Alfred's really harsh on him. He brings him in. He's like, why are you doing this? Why are you? And he only has two people there to interview for him, Dick Grayson and Tim Drake. So they perform their interviews, and he really doesn't find like a lot to go on Bruce being a bad parent to Jason. And when he does finally interview Bruce is like, you know, my only downfall was that of all the kids that I've rescued before, they didn't have family or something that they can go to. Tim had his father, but if you remember, Tim Drake's father was in a coma. So Bruce took care of him a lot. And whereas Jason, he had a mother. And if you remember when he got killed by the crowbar, when Joker beat him to death, he went over there to meet his mother. And Bruce let him do that. And that's kind of like the thing that the social worker's going off of. So I just, man, this book is so good. It's like one of my favorite Bat books, because it truly is like a Bat family book. They have more than just Bruce. It's everybody. And I really dig it. I highly recommend it. It's really good stuff.
That's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And they had these ones do have, this is from November 2003. They do have, Backups, which is Batman Bat Black and White, and it's usually a bunch of independent creators. And this one features art from Nathan Fox, who's done a lot of Image books, and he did some Kirby remake stuff for Dynamite. So it was really cool to see his black and white art on Batman. So, having said that, I'll let you, Rob, take over with your final pick.
Yeah, this is it. Okay. So I'm gonna talk about a horror movie that I watched a couple nights ago. It's from 1989. It's called Intruder. And I don't know if you guys have heard of the subscription service called Shudder. S-H-U-D-D-E-R.
Yeah, I saw the ad on Facebook one time and clicked on it. It's like a horror movie.
Yep.
But it's an interesting horror movie because a lot of the titles are, I don't know, like, I would say like B-film-ish?
They have a lot of lesser known stuff.
Yeah.
And I've been going through my free Amazon Prime horror movies for a couple of years now. So I was getting to the point where there wasn't a lot left that either I wanted to try or I hadn't already seen. So I figured I would try this. Recently Amazon, set up that you can get a few different types of subscriptions directly through Amazon Prime, and Shudder is one, along with, like, you could do Showtime or Stars and stuff, but Shudder was one. So I went ahead and picked that up. It's $4.99 a month. And so I was searching through for something to watch the other night, and this one caught my attention because
you always watch these like late at night.
Yeah. Yeah, I watch them. I watch them on my Kindle Fire, mm-hmm. just in bed. Cause my wife falls asleep. I'll just put this up, prop it up on a pillow on my chest when I'm lying there with my, you know, in my side of bed, and I'll just sit there and watch them with my headphones on. So, I was looking through, and this is definitely just not even a B film, probably a C film, but it was produced by and co-written by Lawrence Bender, who produced a lot of Quentin Tarantino's earlier movies like Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction. So I knew that name, so I'm like, that's kind of interesting. And the other name on there was what's his name? Sam Raimi.
Oh yeah.
And Bruce Campbell. So I'm like,
wow.
What's going on with that, right?
Got the Evil Dead connection there.
Yeah, yeah. So, and then I started reading some of the notes on it, and apparently in the trailer, they kept showing, like, Bruce Campbell and Sam Raimi, and really they've got these tiny, 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 tiny little parts.
but that's usually what those type of films do, is they, right. they milk a known property when, in fact, that they're not even hardly in the film. They might be like a cop that shows up.
That's exactly what it is. Bruce Campbell's like a cop that I think shows up in the last 2 minutes of the movie. But it was just interesting to me. So I'm like, well, I'm going to go ahead and give this a try. And then in the opening credits, the makeup special effects was Greg Nicotero. I don't know if you guys know him, but he does all the special effects for Walking Dead now. And he actually does some of the directing for Walking Dead. So I'm like, he's the guy. He's an older guy with a white ponytail. I don't know if you've ever, if you guys watch Walking Dead, but
I watched Walking Dead and I've seen him. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So
I'm not well aware of him. I mean, the only like special effects guy that I know by name is Tom Savini.
Of course.
Just because he's in all those movies too.
But so I'm like, okay, well, you know, I really wasn't expecting much. It was sometimes when I'm watching these, if it's a little later at night, I'm like, you know, I'm just going to watch this because it's not something I'm going to have to really, really pay attention to. But if it looks like something that's going to be a little bit more in depth, I'll make sure it's earlier in the night where I feel like I'm not going to fall asleep. But this one with Intruder, basically what it was is it's a slasher type movie, and it starts at a supermarket at night as a bunch of people are closing the stores, and just before the store closes, this guy comes in. He's like dressed like with a black leather jacket with chains and spikes and stuff, and he's, you know, dressed to look like he's no good, and he's apparently a boyfriend of one of the cashiers named Jennifer, and they start talking, getting in an argument, Turns out he'd just gotten out of jail. They're arguing, so the two owners of the store come rushing down and get into a scuffle and stuff. They throw him out of the building and so on and so forth. So after that happens, they lock the store up. The owners gather everyone around. There's about maybe eight kids or whatever that are part of this night crew. They gather them around and they say that they're selling the store and they're going to be out of a job. So all the people there are pretty upset. They're going to lose their jobs. The guy that there's two, the two owners, one looks like an office guy. The other one's dressed like everyone else. He's in jeans and he's obviously works with the crew. And the office guy, I think his name was David. He walks back to the office. The other guy's name, escapes me. Oh, Bill. He's like, you know what? He's like, I didn't want to sell. This supermarket's my life. He's like, but the split is 51-49. I've got the 49 and I had no choice. So I'm going to have to sell the store. He's pretty upset, but what can you do? So, everyone goes back to start cleaning up the store and marking things down and stuff like that. And the phone rings and this cashier, Jennifer, answers the phone and it's her boyfriend, just this ex-boyfriend, Craig, bothering her somewhere. And she hangs up on him. And the other cashier, she starts getting ready to leave. Apparently she was just finishing up from the night shift, but not overnight. So she's getting ready to leave and she's getting like groceries for herself. She walks out and somebody that you can't see actually stabs her and kills her. A couple minutes later, Bill, the owner that works with the crew, sees somebody like playing around by the back door. He goes out to investigate and finds his ex-boyfriend, Craig, peeking on his ex-girlfriend through a bathroom window, and they start fighting, and Craig grabs Bill's hammer and hits him on the side of the head, knocks him out. That's the end of that scene. And from that point on, it's a pretty by-the-numbers slasher movie where in even so far as I was surprised that each person in the night crew starts getting killed off one at a time, but it doesn't even get to the point. Like, you know how usually like two or three get killed. And then after that, the ones that are left start finding out that other people are dying. Mm-hmm. This doesn't happen until way, way later in the movie. Like literally there's like one or two people that are left before anyone even realizes that anyone's dead.
Huh.
The owner, Danny.
I like when they break the norm.
Yeah, and this was a little bit different, and the ending was different too. So when I get there, I'll let you know. But the owner, the business owner, Danny, gets like his face pushed into one of those spikes where you put all the like paper, like the bills and stuff, and you throw them down on it, like a paper spike to keep everything together. And then like, you know, people are getting killed by chef's knives. They're getting killed by those box crushers. I don't know if you guys ever worked in a supermarket or anything like that, but they've got those big box crushers. Yeah. Somebody gets killed that way. Gets killed with meat hooks, meat cutters, stuff like that. So by the time that this girlfriend, Jennifer, realizes that anything's up, everyone's gone. Right. So basically the next part of this is she's going around all different parts of the store and discovering bodies and body parts all in different areas. Right. So you still have never seen who this killer is, but obviously it's implied that it's this ex-boyfriend, Craig. So somebody starts attacking her and she runs away and she turns around and it's Craig, and she knocks him out. He staggers, or she staggers and starts running, and who comes in but that guy Bill, who got knocked out outside. He's like, bastard Craig knocked me out and just came to. He's like, you know, hang on for a second. I'll call the police. She's like, okay, good. So she's sitting there. She starts noticing because Bill had like grabbed and embraced her and went back to the phone. She starts noticing that she's got like blood all over her back where his hands have been. She looks and one of his hand has blood on it and stuff. And it becomes very obvious to her that this guy Bill is the one that had killed everyone, not this Craig. So, sure enough, he can tell by looking at her that now she's scared. So he starts attacking her. Craig comes, it wakes back up and they start fighting. So they take the fight all the way outside and they're beating each other up and stabbing each other. And they finally get Bill pretty badly stabbed. Meantime, Jennifer runs into the phone booth outside and calls the police. And of course, typical, you know, slasher pick, the person who's the killer who's stabbed, he jumps back up and smashes through the booth and get at her. And they're fighting and everything. And then all of a sudden Craig comes up from behind him and hacks him and he drops. The police come. Now all three of them are covered with blood. Bill's just lying there on the ground and Craig and Jennifer are covered in blood. And so when the police arrive, they park over by Bill's body. And as Bill's about to die, he basically screams to the police as he's dying that the two of them, Jennifer and Craig, went crazy and killed everyone, which is obviously a lie. And they start screaming, it's a lie, it's a lie. And then Bill dies, like kind of laughing, and then he dies. And the police, the last scene is basically the police come, they arrest the two and start getting ready to put them in the car. So basically they're blamed for the murder, which that was a big surprise. It wasn't the typical ending where you have like the one or two people that make it out alive and then they get away. It's this killer actually puts the blame on them and the police totally believe the guy and they get arrested for everything that happened. All in all, this is definitely not this isn't a stellar movie by any means, but just the couple little twists on there and the fact that it had some names on there that I recognized made it interesting enough for me to watch the whole. I actually only watched about an hour of it that night and I was getting too tired. It was interesting enough that I finished watching it the next morning before I went to work. So all in all, definitely not the best horror movie I've ever seen, but it had enough differences that it made it interesting to watch.
That sounds like a good ending.
Yeah, it was definitely, it was not with, you know, I've watched enough of them that I was assuming that Craig was not the killer and it was going to be somebody else. I didn't know it was going to be.
There's very few horror movies that flip it, like,
right,
and shock you anymore. Because
they've been done
into a, they fall into a formulaic, and that doesn't necessarily make it bad.
No, it doesn't make it bad at all.
I still enjoy it, but I do like when they do things different. Like, one of my favorite horror movies is April Fool's Day.
Uh-huh.
And I absolutely love it because it's so different, and I don't want to give it away for those that haven't seen it, but it leads you to believe one thing, and then it's something like totally different.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like I said, I mean, I really enjoyed just the fact that, like, that, and I did not expect the ending where this guy was going to try to blame the murders on them as he's dying his last breath. And then the police are basically putting them away. That was really, unexpected to me. And there was enough to it that, like I said, held my interest. It's not something I necessarily would watch again, but it held my interest and I enjoyed watching it. You know,
those are good films to watch before bed where you don't have to think much. And
that's exactly it.
It's just like entertains you enough to,
yeah,
make you want to finish it.
Yeah, and I'm a big horror guy. I like trying just all different movies, and you know, some are great. And I mean, I've watched quite a few where they were unexpected surprises that I absolutely loved. So you never know what you're gonna get.
Did you read Roman Ritual?
No.
Oh, you gotta read that. That's good horror right there.
All right.
Amigo Comics.
That's a comic?
Yeah.
I'm gonna have to write that down and take a look at that.
El Torres writes great horror comics.
And really good scary horror comics are hard to actually pull off.
Yeah.
Well, that's about it for me for that movie. But yeah, I usually watch at least one a weekend.
Cool. I used to do that. I was on a big kick, especially with like every year they'd have the eight films to die for. I would get all eight films and analyze them to see which one was the best because I always liked that concept. But Chris, you got anything else?
No, that was it for me.
All right, I just have one more and it's gonna be sweet and short. I continue my journey on Swamp Thing, and right now I'm in book two of the Alan Moore Swamp Thing, and this one was like a straightforward story. It opens up with Swamp Thing like digging. This is by Alan Moore with Sean McManus as an artist. Karen Berger's the editor, who eventually was the editor of Vertigo. So he's just digging a lot. Abby shows up. She's being kind of goofy. She's in a good mood. Swamp Thing does. He seems amiss, like he's not really paying attention to her a hell of a lot. But she's telling her how her life's changed, and since that last incident with the demon, and the place she works, things are going a lot better. And they treated that weird incident as mass hysteria, and everything's turning back to normal. And her husband. She's not like in a relationship with Alec or Swamp Thing at this point. She's with her husband, who seems really weird. Like he's got a demon inside him, and he's like an alcoholic. But she says he's getting better and stuff. But he ends up continuing to dig this thing, and he keeps on seeing a ghost of himself, of Alec. And if you remember in the last few issues, you find out that Alec is really, really dead. Like Alec's dead. And the plants were able to absorb his persona and memories, even though he's physically dead. Originally, he thought he was Alec Holland turned into a monster, but Alan Moore changed it, so it's really the plant. And he ends up following himself, Alec Holland, to this old cabin where it gives a flashback scene with him and his wife. And their relationship right before the corporation came and tried to kill him, and he eventually ended up getting blown up and jumping into the swamp and turning to a Swamp Thing. But it was a really cool origin story. It was essentially, Alan, you had 7 issues to develop the Swamp Thing, and now you're gonna tell your origin story. So he was just revisiting the origin story. He eventually finds his body where his skeleton is, and that's where he puts the skeleton. He basically buries himself. But it was a really cool issue, and I am so into Swamp Thing right now. I'm really feeling it. All the books that I read this week were so damn good. It's hard to stop, but I have to stop because the fire hose is always open, and I have to read new stuff.
That's right.
So it's a difficult thing, but 'cause I don't want the fire hose to totally get out of control, or else I could get wrapped up in a lot of back issues, and I could just keep going and
You'll
run with
drown
it.
in all that water from the fire hose if you don't keep
That's right,
going.
drowning it. But keep an eye out for books from Amigo if you like horror, like Straitjacket right now. That one is if it's El Torres, he writes really good horror, especially like if things like The Exorcist and movies like that, paranormal stuff, he writes it really, really well.
I see that Roman Ritual has a trade paperback too that collects all 4 issues, so I might look at that.
Yeah, it's really good horror. Like me and Bill on Geek Brunch, we absolutely love Amigo Comics because of El Torres. Like I think he has his books translated, like he writes them and then has somebody translate them, but they translate really well. Like I think he's from Spain or something, but
Yeah, it looks like it, or Italy or something. Yeah.
he's really, really freaking good.
Cool. Yeah, I'm gonna look up that and see what I can find.
All right, well, I think that wraps us up. I want to thank you for joining us for this marathon,
Yeah.
and I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed talking to you, Rob.
I
And
did
like you
too.
said, it was our first time we got to talk after many, many conversations on Twitter and other things.
Yeah, I had a great time, you guys, and I definitely would be up for doing this again if you ever would be
Very,
interested.
very cool. I definitely would like to have you on for sure during October when we could get into a
Oh
Halloween themed
yeah.
episode.
Yeah,
I
that'd be
think it
cool. Yeah,
would be pretty
absolutely.
awesome.
Yeah, we'll try to coordinate, man, some kind of meetup sometime since we're
Yeah.
same. I know we've mentioned that before.
Yeah, exactly.
We missed each other last time, so something will come up sometime. We
Oh,
can meet
yeah.
up.
And you've been part of the Nerdy Legion podcast, so you want to plug that and give your Twitter information and
Oh,
all that
sure.
good
Yeah.
stuff.
So I've been doing, I'm not on as often as Martin and Nick. They're kind of the stalwarts for that, but I'm on and off. I'm trying to get back on a little bit more often, but on the Nerdy Legion podcast, and you can reach me at Rob Krieger on Twitter. And I think that's about it, though.
Cool.
And you can reach us at geekbrunchpodcast.com, Geek Brunch Podcast on Facebook. Click the like button, leave an iTunes review, and at MythMakingETC, at Mike Myers Brunch on Twitter, MythMakingETC@gmail.com, and Mike@comicbooknoise.com. And I think that's it. It's been a really fun episode. Made me want to go read some Vigilante and some Teen Titans, which is not what I need right now. Plus, you give me the horror movie itch. Like, I notice when I'm on business travel, and I do that a lot with my iPad, is I'll like get on Netflix and I'll watch these horror movies, and I think like 80% of the time I enjoy them, and I don't know, it's like a good escape, something right before bed. And sometimes you can find a real gem. I mean, sometimes
That's
you're like,
right.
hell, this is really creepy and scary, and I never even heard of it.
And that's the
Just.
thing for me is that a bad horror movie I can still enjoy.
That's the way I feel about horror and sci-fi in general.
Yeah. Whereas some other ones is like, oh, I can't sit
Oh,
through this.
the other thing I love is Grindhouse, like B film, like
Oh
just
yeah.
Yeah.
stuff like that I could really get into, and I end up laughing at some of it, but I like dig the hell out of it. So sexploitation
Cool.
films in the 70s are hilarious. And then they have all kinds of cool characters like Sid Haig and all
Oh
kinds of
yeah.
actors that we know today, you know, that Captain Spaulding. Yeah, I want to thank you for joining us, and we'll talk to you later. Chris, anything you want to say before we hang up, or?
I don't think so. Thanks again, Rob. It was
Yeah,
good
thank
talking
you
to you.
very much. I really appreciate
Oh
you
yeah,
guys letting me come on.
one other thing is, if you want to be a brunch buddy on the Geek Brunch Retrocast, do what Rob did and send me a tweet or an email. You can also tell Chris too, and then we'll hook you up on the show.
If you want to, yeah. You know, you can tell me too.
Yeah. There you go. All right.
Sounds good.
Have a good Super Bowl Sunday. Talk to
Thanks,
you guys
guys.
later.
All right,
Bye.
guys, take it easy. Bye.
Yeah.